Just gone a quarter to eight on this Friday morning. It is OTB AM. Adrian with you as always on a Friday morning. This is normally the point where I go. And as always, Owen Shane is here, but he ain't. He's away on his holidays. So you'll have to, I think, 2 weeks in the States. So good old time for Owen. And good morning to you, Owen. I'm sure he's tuned in this morning as he prepares for departure. But in his stead, Conor McKeown, how are you getting on?
Good, Adrian.
Sports writer with the Herald and the Independent as well. Delighted to have you in with us this morning. Plenty of good stuff to get in. Presume Friday mornings generally for you are not this early.
To sleep enough.
A one-year-old is going to get you out of bed anyway.
Well, that's true, yeah. She was born the day after the Masters finished last year, so I said that she'd have to take in all 4 days of it this year. You know?
What was the due date?
No, I went over last year, yeah.
You were secretly happy enough.
Yeah, obviously. I was secretly hoping Patrick Reed didn't bring it to a playoff.
We've both been watching a little bit of the coverage, well, actually, in your case, quite a lot of the coverage last night, and you've unearthed a brand new broadcasting stream, essentially, from the Masters. And who knew the sort of, you know, we've been discussing on the show during the week about some of the kind of Neanderthal ways, I suppose, of the Masters over the years, but they're pushing the envelope here.
Yeah, it kind of came out of the blue, although I saw that some American media outlets had pieces ready to go about it. But, like, it wasn't exactly flagged during the week, but like historically, the Masters Thursday was pretty much defined by people moaning about the fact that they couldn't watch a whole pile of it because the very basic media rights packages and the way that the Masters Committee sold them to NBC and they're obviously it doled off the Sky as well. But it was yesterday, and people said you can go onto the Masters website. And the Masters website is a very good way of streaming content, but you have to have an American IPN address. But you could, you know, anybody who follows golf will have an app on their phone that will show them who's playing which hole. Yeah. It'll show them a map of the hole, where the ball is going, where they hit their second shot from. But from
a little bit of an animation, essentially, saying, yeah.
But from yesterday, you could watch every single shot. They had a camera on every single player on the golf course. So even though Shane Lowry was out in the early starters, 4 hours before the live coverage on TV started, and not in a group that would have been considered a feature group or anywhere close, you could watch every single shot that he played yesterday, which is, like, revolutionary. And I suppose
legally from here, or...?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Why not?
No, legally from here, that part of it, the feature groups, I think you have to go through. But like you can watch every single shot on that tracker. Which, like, if you have a smart TV and
that's incredible.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Every single shot from every single player.
Yeah, it's like it's the next generation of sports coverage, and specifically golf coverage, which ironically has come from the good people at Augusta National.
Yeah, that's incredible. And is it not the live clip, is it, or is it
it's
marginally delayed?
It's pretty much right. Playing on cue. You won't see footage of a player walking to their ball. You know you won't get the little fluffy commentary and the background music of the birds tweeting in the in the plumage. But no, you'll see every single shot. And like, if you are following a particular golfer, just say you are a big Shane Lowry fan, and he's not going to get a whole pile of live golf coverage. Albeit, it probably wasn't worth watching yesterday in Larry's case. But, you know, you could watch every single shot, which is incredible, because even the Masters do strange things with their, you know, even their feature groups. They pick four feature groups, and you can watch those live. But yesterday, Rory McIlroy wasn't among them, and he was the favourite going into this Masters, and there are so many storylines and narratives that revolve around Rory McIlroy going into this, but for some reason they deemed his group unworthy of being one of the feature groups.
Incredible, isn't it? Yeah. Well, he's not American, I suppose, is the first thing, but I mean, he does play out well with an American audience. So
yeah, well, that's the whole point. After Tiger Woods, I would imagine he is the biggest draw for television viewers in golf.
I am conscious that there'll be a whole bunch of people watching who weren't up as late as... No, Dev, I think people will care, but who maybe weren't up as late last night. So Bryson DeChambeau and Brooks Koepka are the joint leaders after the opening day of the Masters, both on 6 under par, both shooting 66s, and one clear of Phil Mickelson, who is hanging in there in a big way. So Phil was one off the lead heading into day two, and then it is Ian Poulter and Dustin Johnson after that. So really stacked leaderboard, it has to be said, already after only day one. And Rory McIlroy shot a 1 over par. Shane Lowry shot a 78, I think, at the end. So some good photographs of him that we'll show you in just a few minutes' time. So that's kind of the state of play at the Masters. But yeah, like, it's such an interesting thing. And who knew that Augusta National would be the people that would sort of press ahead with this broadcasting technology. It'd be good to see. I mean, it's a totally unfair comparison in a lot of ways, because obviously it's 4 days of a tournament that's totally set up to capture all shots. It's really just utilising, making better use, I suppose, of all the cameras and technology they have in place. So it's an unfair comparison. But it'd be good to see a bit more of this in GAA. Like, it's infinitely frustrating for somebody like me from Westmeath, whose team will play in Division 3, Division 2 next year, Division 3 of the National League this year, and you get to see none of it. Like, there's no highlights, there's no... I'd love to sit down and watch some live coverage of it, and I'm sure the audiences aren't going to be massive, right? The population of Westmeath is not huge, but at the same time...
There does seem to be some movement towards it. I know the Dublin County Board streamed on a YouTube channel or some way through their website the first round of the Dublin Senior Football Championship on Wednesday night when St. Oliver Plunkett's started. And I think there is a kind of movement towards that, but there seems to be a sticky... Because I think Armagh tried it in the National League a couple of years ago. There seems to be a sticky sort of a rights issue in that the GAA sell the rights to the National League games, but the county boards are saying, well, like, we didn't sign over anything.
Well, and if it's inter-county, then it's in conflict with existing national rights deals, whereas if it's from a club point of view, I know there are obviously broadcasters who operate in that space, but I think there's a little bit more wiggle room, essentially.
Yeah, and I think that's probably the future of it. I think it is unrealistic to expect that, you know, RTE or the Sunday game or League Sunday are going to, like, if you show one Division 3 game, then you have somebody in the other Division 3 county, then why didn't you show our game? So I think if we do get more blanket coverage, if we do get more greater depth of coverage around the leagues, and of all the competitions, the leagues are really the one, because, like, it's, you know, people might say, well, Division 3 isn't the highest standard, but the fact is it's hugely competitive
all the Westmeath games this year, there was only mainly just a few scores between them. They were all
even even in Division 3, the crack that ultimately led to the big suspensions for Stephen Poacher, but that whole promotion relegation thing in the last couple of days of the season, that I'm sure was hugely intriguing. But I think if there is going to be some sort of pioneering greater depth of coverage, it would probably have to come from the counties themselves rather than the broadcast partners.
Yeah, I don't know. It is frustrating, and it will, like, the frustrating part for me is that it will happen. It will definitely happen that these games at some point will all be streamed live. You will be able to get access to them. You may have to pay for it, but it will exist, and technology is there. Like, it's there is a little bit of an investment in terms of putting some of that technology in place, but it's all there if you wanted to go ahead and do it. So I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there isn't going to be a Brexit style sort of petition to get behind showing every Westmeath game.
Even as it is, like, there's a lot of technology at matches, you know, between teams videoing the games for themselves, you know. Like, every match is recorded, like that footage exists. So you would imagine that if a team has a stats man or a video person who can video the game in a high quality way that it can be broken down for the purposes of analysis, that a similar one could be set up by the county board to video the game and be able to stream it.
And you accept as well that it's not, if you are going to look at that game, you accept that it's not going to be the full 15 camera broadcast. Like, you understand that straight away. So I don't know. The other thing that sort of caught my eye, it was an inevitability really with the Masters. It caught my eye particularly because Owen Sheehan, as I mentioned, is off now for a couple of weeks. I mean, maybe that's coincidence or not, but I kind of expect him to crop up in this kind of a context at some point soon over the next few days. The Kerry jerseys at the Masters. There was two of them. This was the only guy I spotted, but Neil Tracy, our colleague at Off the Ball, reliably informs me there was two of them.
Yeah, it's a Masters tradition. But I think if you look out for a specific jersey at a sports event, I think inevitably you're going to see it. Like, I have a friend who has a theory that no matter where you are in the world, you're never more than 50 feet away from somebody in a Mayo jersey, and he's yet to be proven wrong.
Kerry jerseys, it always buggers the hell out of me. This is. Sheehan, of course, has to have his response here that his game, he's been up in Northern Ireland for most of the week, indulging himself. He was on a jolly, essentially, for Game of Thrones. And is lashing out at me there is really the only way I can describe it. That I had a few things to say about Seamus Coleman the other week. I mean, they were slightly... I mean, I could have picked better timing for my Seamus Coleman remarks. Is that how I'll describe them? You know, the fact that he's gone on to be shortlisted for the Player of the Month in the Premier League hasn't helped, and he's proven... This was never in doubt, but he's proven what a gentleman he is as well off the pitch over the last week, so...
Pick your moments.
Timing could have been better.
Yeah.
Right, we do want to hear from you this morning. We've lots of good stuff coming your way between now and just after 9 o'clock, so please do keep your comments coming into us. We're going to let you know what's happening in the sports pages in just a few moments' time. We're going to discuss Liverpool as well. Obviously, their game against Chelsea this weekend is very much the game of the weekend and probably the most difficult game that Liverpool will have in the run-in, so we're going to be joined by Gareth Roberts of the Anfield Wrap That is at about 8:10. We're going to discuss GAA Dublin with Conor as well. Will Dermot Connolly be back is the big question we'll put to Conor in just a few minutes' time. The sports news with Tom Malone coming your way about 8:30. And after that, Alan Quinlan, as always, on a Friday in studio with us to discuss the week before the Champions Cup, obviously the next big round of the Champions Cup. So, and Israel Folau as well will come up as well over the course of that conversation. The Masters, John Duggan will be in studio to reflect on the opening day and what we've learned from that at about 9:00. And we were down at the Aviva during the week to the launch of the Union Cup Dublin 2019. And we spoke to Ireland international Lindsay Peat, who is also a basketball international and is also won an All-Ireland with Dublin. So some fairly decent sporting pedigree it has to be said with Lindsay Peat there. And that's coming your way at about 9:15. Time now, though, for the papers. We're going to kick off with the front page of the Irish Independent sports section here. This is, for me, one of the photographs across the entire day. Shane Lowry there. It's, when you look at the, it's actually quite atypical in a lot of ways. Shane Lowry photograph is the one thing that strikes me, and it's probably something he needs to have a chat with himself about. But the exasperation on his face and his body language, like I'm sure any sports psychologist would be saying, Shane, Shane, Shane.
It kind of makes him what he is, though. Like, you kind of, like, he hasn't followed up any of his wins with any sort of great line of form, but he scraped into the Masters, and you're thinking, well, he's now scraped into it. But it was such a big deal. Like, when he won in Abu Dhabi back in January, he was already talking about what that's going to mean for him going to the Masters. So you can imagine he's had 4 months of a lead-in, and then to go out and shoot the score that he did yesterday. Like, he's, barring America, like, he's out of the golf tournament, you know.
So. Yeah, and he's kind of accepting of that as well, which is, like, he's, and this is why people love him, but he's so not Rory McIlroy in so many ways. Frustrated McIlroy admits to making too many mistakes is the other line there from Vincent Hogan of the Irish Independent. And GAA rules out the use of TMO technology in championship, writes Colm Keyes here. And we are coming back to that story in just a few minutes' time. The front page of the Irish Examiner sports section, meanwhile, the bogeyman, and a picture of Rory McIlroy here in action at the Masters yesterday. Rory struggles for consistency at Augusta as a tiger on a roll. And the splash across the top there as well. Single-minded, it's clear where GAA would stand on Irish unity poll, says the GAA president, John Horan. That's in the Irish Examiner. I think you've got the Daily Mail there, Conor.
Yeah, the Daily Mail lead with easy tiger. Woods rolls back the years with a first-round 70. And I think a lot of the Irish newspaper golf coverage is coloured by the fact that they probably went to print prior to, and all the guys up the top of the leaderboard were actually quite laid out, because Brooks Koepka shooting 600 par is a very, very significant development for the first round of a, if it was a, it was another golfer, you'd think, well, you know, you're under pressure, but this guy doesn't have nerves, so he could actually pull away. And the off-lead from Philip Quinn is football family lose patience with the FAI. This is more follow-up to yesterday's story of the PFAI issuing a very strong statement about John Delaney and the governance of the FAI.
The sports front page of the Irish Daily Star, Blues Salah race shame. This is the story that a bunch of Chelsea supporters, following their Europa League game, were involved in a racist chant in the direction of Mo Salah, and it's been condemned, obviously, by the various sporting bodies, and we'll see what action is taken there. It obviously wasn't in the sporting field of play, but in a pub after the Europa League game in Prague, so we'll see what action is taken out of that. And Tiger right in the hunt, as you say. Conor, a lot of those headlines slightly out of date, almost, in terms of everything that's going on.
Yeah, I suppose the Tiger one is just incredibly interesting, because he hit, I think, 10 of the first 11 fairways yesterday, and you're thinking, like, if this fella drives the ball straight all week, he's going to win. And the first fairway he missed was on the 10th, and he managed to make a birdie from the end of the bushes. So he made for great television yesterday. He always does, but particularly yesterday. The Mirror's back page is the same Mo Salah story. Vile. Chelsea fans in Prague labelled a disgrace after being filmed saying Salah is a bomber. The top of the page is Tiger Rolls. It's reference to the Tiger Woods story. And on the right, PFA hit out at new low for a local game. This is the very strong PFAI statement yesterday. Again,
it's a theme that's also picked up on the Irish Sun this morning. Rotten. PFA, FAI blast Delaney and co. This is Owen Cowser writing here, following that statement from the PFAI yesterday. Also that racism storm reflected upon here by Andrew Dillon, and Arsenal's 2-0 win over Napoli. Unai foot in semis. In the Sun.
And the Irish Times leads with golf, predictably enough, with Philip Quinn in Augusta Philip Reid. Woods back in familiar territory, and tough finish caps a day of more ups and downs. Philip Reid making the point that in no other golf course in the world is experience and knowledge of the course so beneficial as Augusta, and nobody is as experienced in Augusta as Tiger Woods.
Yeah, we'll see if he can craft his way around it over the weekend. Sponsors up, FAI Pressure, the Times Ireland edition rides here. This is again that ongoing story that Conor mentioned a few moments ago. Shot of mixed day from McIlroy is the main photograph there on the back page as well. Kane looks set to miss running, writes Gary Jacob. This is the injury that they've managed to get a mention of World Cup in 1966 into the opening paragraph of. Harry Kane has suffered a serious ankle injury that could scupper his hopes of captaining England to their first trophy since the World Cup in 1966. Never miss an opportunity, as Declan Lynch would say, to discuss the World Cup in 66 and Falau's World Cup in doubt. Quite generous headline, I would suggest, that I think his entire career is in doubt by all accounts following his homophobic outburst during the week.
And just the racing post here, Leeds would let the good times roll. Foxes are flying under Rogers. This is the probably escaped under the radar with the hysteria about the title run in, but the fact that Brendan Rogers has led Leicester to four wins in succession of five of the last six ahead of their Premier League game with Newcastle tonight.
Yeah, I still have to remind myself that he's actually the Leicester manager. And the Herald, meanwhile, time for change. This is again further reflections on the various statements that have come out yesterday. Richard Dunn's thoughts as well, and Aidan Fitzmaurice with some considered thoughts on the committee hearing during the week. So some FAI top brass there on the way into or out of the Oireachtas committee during the week. That's the Herald. And one last one for you as well. The Irish News sports section here. GAA stance on border poll pretty clear. Admit Horn is the main story there, as well as some of the golf. And it was a story that we wanted to pick up on from John Horn on a United Ireland. It's on the inside of the Examiner sports section today. This really is on the back of the statements from Gerlach Burns and from Joe Brawley as well in the last few weeks, saying that the GAA would need to back a poll, as it's described, not quite a vote, but there seems like there might be some sort of a border poll in relation to whether Irish unity could be a thing or not. Joe Brawley talks about it happening maybe at some point in the next decade. In relation to United Ireland, if or when I suppose it was to happen. So John Horan is commenting on it here. The main hook around the story is a quote from him. He was at a launch of a club in Derry yesterday in Limavady. We look upon ourselves as a 32-county organisation, says John Horan, so I think it's pretty clear where the GAA would stand if such a poll came, i.e. they would be in support of a 32-county Ireland. How that would manifest itself, I'm not sure, and whether the GAA, I suppose, Conor, have a role to play in politics.
It's an interesting one, and it's the point I think that Joe Brawley has been making repeatedly in the last few weeks, and Gerlach Burns as well, that not only should the GAA be leaning towards, you know, a United Ireland, if that is the question being asked in any referendum, they should be actively campaigning for it, or they should be at least publicly backing such a move. It's an interesting one because in the past, the GAA have run a mile from taking any major political stance. If you remember the marriage equality referendum, I think David Gough, who was refereeing at Croke Park, was refused to wear maybe a rainbow wristband. Or
yeah, it was laces or something. Yeah, it was one or the other anyway, yeah.
And like the stance that the GAA took during that, which is an absolutely perfectly acceptable stance, was that we are an apolitical organisation. We are a sporting and cultural organisation. We do not take stances on political issues. And you can't say that a referendum on whatever the referendum is not a political issue. I understand completely what John Horan is saying. Like from an organisation that has an All-Ireland Senior Football Championship, an All-Ireland Hurling Championship, where there's so much movement around the border, it would be hugely impractical for a hard border or any sort of division to or further division to come up. But to say that you're it's just an interesting one from John Horan.
Yeah, because regardless of Brexit, United Ireland is in so many ways just an entirely separate conversation.
I think there are a lot of people on the island that would love an organisation like the GAA to take a leadership role. You know, to say, well, look, if this is the question being asked, this is the way we would like to think it goes. But I don't know whether that kind of takes for granted what an awful lot of the membership. I heard Declan Bogan here speaking to Shane Stapleton a few weeks ago, and he made the point, like, you know, what does the 21, 22-year-old hurler in Coola think of this? What does, you know,
I think it's a fantastic question. And we're operating on an assumption that the vast majority of the GAA membership would want a United Ireland. But whether that's an actual thing or not, we don't know. And obviously the constitution, or at least the ethos of the GAA, was set up with an All-Ireland, a 32-county Ireland in mind. But like at the same time, what was relevant when the GAA was set up, or relevant or appropriate when the GAA was set up, may not, and most likely is not, appropriate or relevant now.
I think Gerald Bourne's quoted a line in the initial constitution of the GAA, which alluded to the fact that it was a 32-county organisation, and something to do with furthering the cause of, you know, unification. But it's a little bit like the American and the Second Amendment, you know, the right to bear arms. A lot has happened since that was written. You know, it is not, it like that. There's so much context, and there are so many layers of, you know, there's a lot of time has passed, basically, and there are a lot of people on the island that don't have very strong views on this, and a lot of them will be members of the GAA. And I think for anybody at the GAA to maybe assume to speak, I'm not saying that John Horan is now for a second, but I think it'd be quite a bold move, I think, for the
Well, I think he is. I think it's difficult to be absolutely fair to him. It's difficult to read that statement. We look upon ourselves as a 32-county organisation, so I think it's pretty clear where the GAA would stand if such a poll came.
Yeah, that's pretty unequivocal, I think, from John Horan, you know. And it's an interesting move. It's quite bold, because I think you're, you know, I suppose the GAA is, to any individual, the people that they surround themselves with, you know. So there are people in the GAA that would say, yes, of course, everybody in the GAA wants a United Ireland, because they are the GAA members with whom they come into the most frequent contact. But I would imagine that there's a very big body of people in the GAA who wouldn't necessarily ascribe to that view.
No, and it raises all sorts of questions about, like, you know, if there was, how would you even begin to poll the entirety of the GAA community?
Congress.
Like, well, let's talk about democracy. So, I mean, I think that's a fascinating question. And, like, what's the majority that's required to decide that the GAA can suddenly be a voice for politics in Ireland? And let's say, you know, is that two-thirds majority? So we're sort of actively deciding that we're going to alienate 30% of our membership because we've decided this is something we want to get behind.
And so the other
it raises all sorts of questions.
The other thing as well is that, like, is that the GAA's function now? You know, like, like John, I'm sure, was asked the question, I think he was speaking in Derry, and he was asked the question, like, what would, and I presume he's speaking on behalf of the GAA leadership and maybe even in a personal capacity there. But when it comes down to it, if there was a vote, whether the GAA would be an active campaigner in that, that's probably another level again that I don't think that John is maybe, I don't think that's what he is suggesting there, because look, is it the GAA's function to campaign or to be a kind of a political vehicle?
Is it an unfair equivalency that if we were sitting here discussing that the FA, the Football Association of England, were getting involved in the conversation around Brexit, if they were siding with Remain or Leave? It feels to me it's kind of in the same sort of space.
It probably is. But there are, there are historical angles to this conversation too. I think there's a presumption among people who aren't in the GAA that the GAA will be leaning this way politically too.
Well, this would be a fantastic opportunity for them to go, look, we've said before, we're not a political organisation, and that's, we're going to stand by that. And if you're a member of the GAA that believes in a 32-county Ireland, we're with you. And if you're a member of the GAA that believes that it should just stay the way it is, we're with you. And if you don't give a shite, we're with you as well.
Yeah.
Like, surely that's, we talk about inclusivity and it's a theme that comes up across a whole bunch of topics today. Surely that's the way to do it.
Yeah, but similarly, you know, the GAA could take a very neutral stance on the marriage equality, well, no stance whatsoever on the marriage equality referendum, because I don't think it's the sort of political issue that was going to mobilise a lot of members. Like, they're not going to go to Central Council and people sit around and say, lads, why didn't we take a very hardline stance on this? Because I'm not sure how many people would have been that engaged in it at the top level. But I think there is a significant body of people within the kind of higher echelons of the GAA that would like the GAA. And this is kind of the point. This is, I don't think the GAA is sitting on their hands and deciding they've no decision to make is an option now. Because they at least have to decide whether they are going to be active about this or inactive. And that in itself is kind of taking a stance.
Well, look, as you said, if nothing else, that comment this morning is going to kick off more discussions like this. I'm absolutely certain of that. And I'm absolutely certain that the next time he's in front of the media or there's some somebody of significance from the GAA in front of the media, this is a topic that's going to open up again. And I'm sure at some point or another, as you say, they are going to have to come up with some sort of an official stance on it. So I suppose watch this space is the thing. Something completely different. If you pass me over the Irish Times, they're kind of something totally different. And just one thing that we wanted to give a mention to here, it's the, a lot of the papers have done this kind of Augusta diary, obviously, of the various little bits and pieces that have gone in. No Kerry jerseys have made any of these diaries, by the way, which is absolutely outrageous. Kenny gets hands on silverware was the main thing that jumped out at me here. Enda Kenny is in Augusta. I mean, sure, like me,
course,
why wouldn't you be?
Yeah, sort of be
former Taoiseach. Kenny did the honours in his role as global ambassador for the philanthropic organisation ISPS Handa, an organisation, I have to say, I know absolutely nothing about, in presenting Brooks Koepka with his Players Player of the Year award at the Golf Writers Association of America annual prize giving. This is the most unlikely pairing, I think, that if you were to sit here and say, you know, two unlikely people, Brooks Koepka, who leads the Masters, joint leader of the Masters after day one, and our own Enda Kenny, have been in close proximity this week. A visit to Augusta, writes Philip Reid, is old hat for the golfing politician who first visited the Masters back in 1995 in his capacity as Minister for Sport.
I would imagine that would be the least remarkable part of Brooks Koepka's week.
We might leave that one there. We mentioned in the top of the segment here in the, from the newspapers, GAA rules out use of TMO technology in championship from Colm Keyes. In the Irish Independent today, and it's just it's a fascinating one. Calls for the GAA to explore the use of television match officials for intercounty games have been knocked back by Central Council. And the key line here, they were both considered impractical. These are the suggestions from a club in Leitrim and a club in Clare. Impractical at present because of cost issues outweighing any benefits accrued.
Yeah, I think there's a utilisation issue too. What is the scope for TMO? What do you decide on? Is it every foul? Is it every free? Gaelic football, we kind of accept the terms in which Gaelic football are played. But in an inter-county Gaelic football match, there are endless number of frees that go unspotted. There's nearly kind of a pressure gauge on a referee for how severe a free is before they give it. What are you going to do? Are you going to stop an All-Ireland final with 10 seconds to go to see how many players were dragged down on the kick-out? So I think it's a utilisation thing. I think the score detection technology probably has another level to go. The TMO or the Hawkeye, you know, with VAR, where you can actually see where the ball crossed the line. That goal that Waterford were sucker punched with last year in the Minor Hurling Championship. But my understanding is that this new slitter that the GAA want to bring in that has a chip inside it for authenticity purposes and to basically regularise the slitter, that actually what they can do is kind of create a magnetic field around the goal, and you can score detect whether a goal has been scored in hurling. You can tell very, very quickly. Right. Because the problem with Hawkeye is that in hurling, it's not 100% accurate, I still don't think. And in anywhere other than Croke Park, even in Thurles, it takes too long. It kind of kills the momentum of the game, and you don't have the tar or nail, so you're kind of waiting on the referee to put their hand up. So I don't think it's the perfect thing, but if you have score detection technology in a wider number of grounds, I think that's probably as far as the GAA can take technology when it comes to refereeing.
Might be back to that previous conversation we were having about the technology is there, it's going to cost a bit, and it's while it works, while VAR, I mean, in my humble opinion, is an absolute success in football, and it's never going to clear everything up 100%, but has definitely advanced the correct calls versus the wrong calls.
Even if you see a goal scored in Gaelic football and you say, well, hang on, ref, that was 8 steps.
Every goal is eight steps.
You know, when you're about to pull the trigger in Gaelic football, the referee will give you 2 extra steps.
It's crazy. They do. Everybody accepts it's legit.
Yeah.
They do talk about sort of incidences and scores. So there is a possibility that at that point the referee gets to review it and go, actually, hang on, 8 steps, no goal, free out.
Do you do it for a point? Like,
it's a good point. I mean, you'd be there, the game would last, you'd be looking at very good football.
I think of all the things, like for all the problems that there are with refereeing and the accuracy issues around score detection, I think the last thing that Gaelic football needs to be at the moment is more stop-start.
All right. Keep your comments coming into us on the hashtag OTBAM or on our Facebook, YouTube feed, and we'd love to hear from you. We'll bring those comments over the course of the morning. It is just gone 8:15 on this Friday morning on OTBAM. Up next, we're going to talk Liverpool against Chelsea this weekend with Gareth Roberts of the Anfield Wrap. Before that, though, let's hear from the Liverpool legend Ian Rush. He was chatting to Nathan last night ahead of the Sean Cox charity match, which takes place at the Aviva Stadium tonight.
You've met Sean's wife, Martina, you've met the family, so you've got a good sense of what they're going through and the battle that they're facing.
Yeah, I think sometimes that goes unnoticed. Every time I've met her, you know, she's very positive. You know, she's so strong and everything and all that, but you know, it must be difficult for her because she's there morning, noon and night by your side and all that. And
it's weirdly the piece people don't talk about, that there is a minute by minute, hour by hour part of this that they have to somehow get through.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And you know, if I'm sure if she wasn't like that, no, Sean wouldn't be in the position he is today, because she's given him the strength, saying, listen, you can do it. And yes, Sean's got to do it himself, but he needs that support. Now, we're here to support as playing the game, and as a player, and that's the easy thing for us. You know, the hardest thing is his family and everyone, the Sean Cox Foundation, everyone. They're the hard work that goes on behind the scenes. You know, but it's great when you see the hard work behind the scenes. To see that what I seen this morning of Sean, nobody posted up today. That was absolutely amazing, and that's going to give all the players a massive lift and all that. It just goes to show where with all the hard work, you know, where good things can happen.
Yeah, that was Ian Rush in conversation with Nathan last night. Tickets, I think some tickets still available for that game tonight. So get yourself along if you can. 7:45. Kick-off there, you can see all the details. 7:45 kick-off tonight between the Republic of Ireland and Liverpool legends, and Ian Rush will be amongst those on show this evening. So that is that. Liverpool against Chelsea in the Premier League this weekend, one of the games of the weekend. It's live and off the ball on Sunday from 4:30. I'm delighted to say Gareth Roberts of the Anfield Wrap joins us now on the line. Morning, Gareth.
Good morning, boys.
Thanks a lot for taking our call. Of the five games left, obviously, Gareth, it looks like on paper this is the most difficult one for Liverpool, so if they get this done, if they win on Sunday, does it win the league?
No. I think the way we've got to all be looking at it is the old cliche of game by game. And obviously, we've got to see what Manchester City do as well. I think it could be a huge weekend, as you say, in that it's a massive game. Chelsea are traditionally a tough opponent for us. We've got history against them, of course. They've got a good record at Anfield. They spoiled the party last time when we thought we were going for the title. So we're looking for a bit of a revenge on that score. But also, you know, City going to Crystal Palace is huge as well. I think Palace potentially keep them honest and potentially beat them. And obviously, if we beat Chelsea and they lose to Palace, then the whole thing's turned on its head and Liverpool are leading from the front and favourites to win the title again. But right now, we've got to rely on City tripping up and get through what is a very, very tough match.
Yeah, and maybe there's a different kind of a pressure if that eventuality was to crop up post this weekend. Looking at some of the narrative around Liverpool, obviously, has been that they've scraped through a couple of games and maybe been lucky. I mean, there's no maybe about it in certain games. But on the flip side of that, there is a metal about this Liverpool side. If you look at some of the recent results between last month and this, behind early against Burnley last month and obviously go on to crush them in the end. 1-1 with 10 minutes to go against Fulham. They ground out the win there as well. 1-1 at added time, obviously, against Spurs, dig out the win. 1-1 against Southampton last week. They've had their moments, but the evidence of this team, Gareth, is a team that not necessarily that panicked, I would say.
No, not at all. And I think a lot of that comes from Virgil van Dijk. I think the way his calmness that he's brought to Liverpool has spread right throughout the team. And what you're seeing now is a very mentally strong team. I remember when Jurgen Klopp first came and there was a game against Crystal Palace, which we lost at Anfield. And it was the game where he complained about fans leaving. Because basically a goal goes in and everyone went, oh, that's it, it's done. Walked out the ground with 80-odd minutes gone. And he said, we should decide when games are over. And, you know, he wanted people to get behind the team. He wanted the mentality to change both on and off the pitch. And on the pitch that day as well, you saw shoulders slump, you saw heads go down. And the mentality wasn't right when he arrived at the club. I think now you're seeing the complete opposite of that. They all believe in themselves. They believe they can get results. And I like the attitude of them. I think at times they've got a bit of a, to use a Scouse phrase, they've got a bit of a cob on with the national media when they've been asked, you know, are you bottling it? Are you losing it? And they're like, no. Why aren't you asking these questions of Manchester City? And I think they're right to do that. You know, as you say, they've kept on coming back. They've won six on the spin now. And I think the way some of the media has talked about the title race, I'm a Liverpool fan, but it comes across slightly biased. You can turn the internet on any day and you see a poll, will Manchester City win the quadruple? No one's talking about Liverpool winning the double. And yet Liverpool are right there. Liverpool are got one foot in the semi-finals of the Champions League. Liverpool are right at the top of the Premier League. I haven't seen a single person in the national media or at the top of the media talking about Liverpool winning the double. I've seen everyone, it seems, talking about Manchester City winning the quadruple. And Manchester City lost in the week. So, you know, I think there's a bit of a... Klopp's generated a bit of a siege mentality. The fans have as well. I'm really enjoying it. That's the way it should be. It's a fight. It's a battle. Let's go and do battle again on Sunday against Chelsea.
Gareth, is there anything to be said for the theory that the Bayern Munich performance was actually the one that kind of turned that mini slump back on its head? Because they seem to have played in the two legs against Bayern Munich and even the first leg against Porto. They kind of found that freedom again that maybe the pressure of the title race, not that they were bottling it, but that maybe they just couldn't play their best stuff in the Premier League, that the pressure was becoming a factor in Anfield and on the team's performance.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been strange, the Champions League, in that respect, in that it's felt a relief to go to those games. I think we all really enjoyed ourselves against Porto because it wasn't fraught, it wasn't tense. And that's mad to say when you're in the last eight of the European Cup, but it's because everyone wants the title so much, because it's been so long since Liverpool last lifted it. And here we are with a great chance to do it. And when it's coming to the Champions League, it's a bit like, well, let's just enjoy ourselves. And I think if Liverpool go out at any point and don't go all the way and don't win it, I think there'll be less of an outcry from fans that compared to normal, because I think what we've got to say about Liverpool is that whatever happens this season here on in, they've done fantastic. You look at where they are in the league with, I think it's 82 points now. And that ranks right up there in the top five seasons Liverpool have ever had in the Premier League era. And we've still got five games to play. You know, the most points Liverpool have ever got in the Premier League era is 86. Then it's 84. Liverpool are on 82 and can potentially finish on 97. So everyone's got to be saying this has been a superb season for Liverpool and can get even better. And you're right to highlight the Bayern Munich game in that, again, the narrative around that was annoying. You know, it was, oh, Bayern are gone, Bayern are shot, Bayern aren't what they once were. Liverpool go there and win at one of the best stadiums in the world, at one of the biggest clubs in the world. That team then go and batter Dortmund and are in place to win their league. Again, there should be more credit because credit is certainly due.
Mo Salah, obviously, I mean, you talk about one of Liverpool's greatest seasons of all time, I suppose. Mo Salah is not necessarily having, particularly the latter half, his greatest season. Obviously, did break the duck against Southampton, hasn't followed up against Porto. How important is it in the context of Liverpool's run-in that he can harness some of that momentum from the Southampton game and score again this weekend, particularly against Chelsea?
Yeah, absolutely. I think again, though, you know, he scores 44 goals in his debut season for Liverpool. That's phenomenal. That's up there. You know, he's getting really close to Ian Rush's record that you've just had on there. He's the record goal scorer for Liverpool. Scored 47 in one season. Mo Salah nearly breaks that record. And then he scored, I think it's 21 in all competitions this season, which is still outstanding. So he's gone from phenomenal to outstanding. There is no crisis around Mo Salah. And as you say, it did feel like he got something off his back by sort of scoring against Southampton. A fantastic finish as well. He misses one in the week, but I still nevertheless think, you know, Mo is contributing and has been all season. I mean, mentioned the Munich game earlier. His assist for Mane in that game is world class. But it doesn't get talked about as much because it's not a goal. I think as well that, you know, Mo and Mane have been brilliant this season. But what's gone under the radar a little bit lately is the form of Firmino. He's been absolutely brilliant week in, week out for a while now. And I think he could actually be the key player at the current time. There's a lot of focus on Mo. The stats out there that show he's been tackled more this season than last season. And again, we've still got a big chunk of the season to go. So he's being targeted by defenders. You know, managers and defenders aren't daft. They know what he can do. They've been doubling up on him. They've been getting stuck into him. And that's contributed to his goal return. But what it's also done is created space for the other lads, and that's why you've maybe seen Sadio Mane shine a little bit more. But yeah, Mo Salah is our absolute best. There's a huge credit to Liverpool, obviously, and we hope he's on form for Sunday.
Should he have been sent off during the week?
Sorry?
Should he have been sent off during the week?
No, I'm not having it, no. I'm all right with it. I think he was honest when he was going for it. And look, it's another one of those where everyone's watched 1,000 replays and decided that he should have been sent off. But in the context of the game, in the run of the game, it was fine for me.
Your prediction for the weekend?
I'm going to go for an extremely tight game. Look, Chelsea are a good side. They've got a good record against us as well. Eden Hazard, obviously in fantastic form at the moment. I think it'll be very, very tight. I'm going to say 2-1 to Liverpool.
If I gave you a draw, would you take it? Is that a huge dent in Liverpool's ambitions?
I think it would be seen as, and I almost can't be bothered around the fuss that it would create. But personally, yeah, I don't think a draw is the end of the world. I think City will still drop points, will continue to drop points. Really encouraged by the fact that they lost to Spurs. I had a feeling that, you know, that triple header against Spurs would be a problem for them. I still think Palace can be. I still think Burnley can be. I still think Man United can be. So, yeah, a draw wouldn't be the end of the world. But I think, you know, for the momentum, for keeping the media quiet, for keeping us happy, I want the victory, obviously.
One thing to ask you about before we let you off, Gareth. It looks like, from some reports in some of the papers this morning, Liverpool are about to sign the biggest deal in Premier League history, bar none. A New Balance deal, obviously due up at the end of the season. Adidas and Nike, both in the running, it seems, had been worth a cool £45 million a year to Liverpool with New Balance. Looks like it's going to be more now than the £75 million a year deal that United signed with Adidas in 2014. This looks like monster stuff for Liverpool.
Yeah, I mean, it's good news. Look, I mean, you know, money never excites me as much as football, but I think, you know, we're in the modern day and football clubs have to do what they do. And I think the commercial team at Liverpool, the financial team at Liverpool, I've done much better than Liverpool I've done in the past, to be honest. I mean, there's been plenty of mistakes made in the past, I think, around Liverpool, around commercial deals. And we've seen Man United get huge ones and wondered why that couldn't be us, because Liverpool have got a huge reach around the world. I think if this deal gets signed and it's the rumoured figures, then rightly so, really. That's sort of the going rate for a club the size of Liverpool. And I think the New Balance one, you know, it's ran its course. It doesn't sound like they've got the kind of money to compete with the likes of Nike and Adidas. So it looks like it's going to go that way. And fantastic if that means a bigger pot for Jurgen Klopp to go out in the summer and strengthen this side once again, then good news.
Gareth, thanks for taking the call.
Cheers, boys.
Thanks a lot. Gareth Roberts of the Anfield Wrap joining us on this Friday morning. We've had Powernator in touch on Twitter about the Liverpool finishing on 97 points potentially this season and it being a superb season. Another superb season winning nothing, but hold on, great hugs all around.
Well, it's the old question of, you know, like Mayo have played incredible Gaelic football to get so close to Dublin over the last few years. Probably good enough to win an All-Ireland in any other year, but like what Liverpool have to do this year is quite extraordinary to win the title, and anything shy of that and they won't.
Yeah, and we'll see. That game is live on Off the Ball and News Talk this Sunday as well. Liverpool up against Chelsea. We'll see. It should be a huge game, really, and a huge weekend in the context of the Premier League title run. We'll see what happens there. Just coming up at 8:30 on this Friday morning, lots of good stuff coming your way. Alan Quinlan still to come on the weekend's rugby and a little bit more as well. Lindsay Pete, we've been chatting to her during the week, so she is en route before we leave you this morning, and some other bits and bobs too. We're going to be talking golf, obviously, with John Duggan very shortly, and GAA as well next with Connor on OTBAM. So the AIB Club Footballer of the Year, Kieran Malloy, joined Nathan in studio last night. He's one player who has bore the brunt of the unfairness of the GAA calendar.
Unfairness, I think, seems to come up a lot in your situation, from Sigerson missing out on Sigerson because Sigerson tends to be the same weekend as club championship. Have you got your head around it? Like, part of you, so you're going to have one more year of Sigerson. Yeah. And I know you can't do it, but part of you think, well, what's the point of me going into Sigerson if next year, next February, All-Ireland Club semi-final is the same weekend as Sigerson?
Like, you just hope that, like, it's 2 years in a row now they made the same mistake. Like, the first year it was on the same day, and this year it was the day after. And, like, I had to go from Carrick back to Galway, I'd say sleep for 7 hours, and then straight drive down to Cork. And sure, when you got out of the bus, like, your legs, they just weren't functioning right at all.
And that was a massive improvement on the year before, when you literally drove straight from one game to the other.
Well, like, I'd nearly say that was nearly worse, because your legs had time to die down, whereas adrenaline took over the first day. and you didn't think about it. But I remember after the game, I was just on the ground and I could barely move, like, after against UCD. Could barely move.
Yeah, that was Kieran Malloy in conversation with Nathan last night. Conor McKeown is with us still this morning. And, GA, we come to, and when we knew we were having you in, Conor, obviously we want to discuss some Dubs. And people will be saying, well, sure, look at him. I mean, the league is over and we're a few weeks out from the championship, but obviously the Dublin Club Championship is in full flight. And the main talking point is that Dermot Connolly may end up featuring for his club this week, and it may be a big step en route to getting back involved with the county team.
Well, if Vincent's play tonight, they're playing out in Fingallion's ground, Lawless Park out in Swords. They're playing St. Bridget's in the first round of a group stage, and they would be very much expected to win that game. And Clay Connolly has played 3 league games now, I think. They played a challenge match last week that he didn't play. But the most recent league match, he actually lined out at centre-back in an easy win over St. Oliver Plunkett's. So it's going to be interesting on a few levels, because I'd love to see what it looks like, Dermot Connolly playing centre-back.
Yeah. What's he doing at centre-back?
Well, I think for a couple of years, I think Vincent's had an issue getting Connolly into the game, because he's so heavily man-marked. And teams get so many bodies back there that when he gets on the ball, his only role was really to give it off. And it wasn't that he was necessarily being man-marked, it's that he was kind of swallowed in the morass of bodies that get around the middle third. But there's two very good inside finishers in Tomás Quinn and Enda Varley.
Yeah.
But both men are kind of, how would you say, closer to 40 than they are to 30.
Yeah.
And if you can get a ball onto their chest like nobody can, as well as Dermot Connolly can, they are still lethal, absolutely lethal. And I think playing them in a more deeper role is probably designed towards that. But like, the thing is, the big question of Connolly is whether he's going to play for Dublin again. And it would seem as though whatever fire went out in him last year when he was, you know,
off the scene,
seems to be lit again. That he seems to have a real lust for football again. And speaking to Jim Gavin at the end of the league up in Cavan, he made the point that, and now, like I mentioned, Dermot Connolly and Rory O'Carroll in the question, and as Jim does, he kind of talked around it. You know, I said, look, is it open for players coming in? He says, look, anybody who does it in the club championship, anybody who shows form. And I think that Dublin team could do with somebody like Dermot Connolly.
Not in that position, though, sure.
No, certainly not in that position. But I think last year the forward line was so kind of, like, you could pick the forward line all through the championship. Once Brian Howard came on the scene, that six was set in stone. But the problem is, like, you don't know. Like, Brian Howard had an exceptional season last year. Doesn't mean he has an exceptional season year two. Now, Scully's had a couple of great years. You don't know for definitely. He has a third great year. Conor Callan didn't have a great league. Like, there's players that are, like, it was a weird league for Dublin, you know. Like, all their best players, like, this time last year, everyone was talking about whether it was Brian Fenton or Kieran Kilkenny or Johnny Cooper was the player of the year league. Whereas this year, none of them really had consistent league campaigns. But that's reflective of what Dublin did in the league, and that's why you kind of think that there was forces at play that maybe Dublin's training cycle didn't really allow them to be very good in a couple of games. But on Connolly, I think if you have him, he has that spark of genius, a bit of unpredictability that teams, like, it won Dublin the All-Ireland in 2017.
Where do you put him if you're picking that six and all those players are actually playing pretty well and in good form? Like, you're obviously finding room for him in that front six somewhere.
Yeah, I think probably maybe Brian Howard will eventually gravitate towards midfield for Dublin anyway.
Right.
And the role that he plays, whether it's number 10 or number 9, it's not a whole pile of difference. Like, it's an heavy late body. And I think you play Dermot Connolly in a position where he gets on the ball. Like, already you've seen that, like, Kieran Kilkenny is such a creative force for Dublin now that the opposition will put their best man marker, like Mayo did with Lee Keegan in the 2017 All-Ireland final. Mm-hmm. And if you're in a situation where, you know, the opposition's best man marker is marking somebody else, I don't think that... Now, having said that, I haven't seen Connolly, so I'm sort of going on second-hand knowledge of his form. But, like, if he is back fit, if he is back focused, if he is back playing good football with his club, I don't think there's any obstacles in his way.
Right.
Because whatever happened, like, at the end of last season, Jim would have said, 2018 is over. Anybody who can add to the thing in 2019, I think it would be a very straightforward thing. And if he plays well, I don't see any stubborn blocks. And he's willing to come back. That's the unknown that we don't know.
Right.
If he's eager to come back, I think Jim would facilitate it very quickly.
Right. Fascinating. His playing at centre-back for Vincent's will have no great impact either way, right? He's enough of a bank of experience and all of that stuff playing up front.
I think it's really much an interesting like with Connolly, you know, if he's playing to a high standard with Vincent, you know, it obviously means that his head is in the game, and you know, whatever about taking a year off and, you know, kind of like not being part of the four in a row. Like you see Dermot Connolly and you just think, look, this is what this guy was born to do. Yeah. You know? And
Like, it seems as if himself and Jim have had, or himself and the management team at some point or another, is obviously slightly at odds. Is there a conversation when he's coming back in saying, listen, you know, if you're coming in here, you're one of the team, like, you're not cutting the sleeves off your shirt, but we're all, do you know what I mean? Like, it's, you're part of this group and we're all in it together. And
I think there's a...
Do they try and harness the free spirit?
I think nobody knows more than Dermot Connolly what's required to be part of that panel, you know. So, you know, if he comes back, like, he walks in completely with his eyes open, there's an acceptance there. I don't think anybody... He's a huge experienced player. Like, Jim Gavin made him vice-captain when he took over in 2013. You know, he was that highly regarded, not just as a footballer, but as an influence on the rest of the panel. And, you know, he will know full well what the levels of commitment and everything else are required, and he'll walk into it with his eyes open. Yeah, if he does come back, like, I don't think anything is certain, but judging it from the outside...
You expect it, listening to you, you expect it.
I would think that it's more probable than possible. Yeah. You know, and like if the question is from Jim Gavin, is your squad better with Dermot Connolly in it or without or out? It's not a question.
Yeah, fascinating. It's too simple a solution to say that he fixes everything, obviously, when he comes back. But, you know, three losses in the league. You've written a piece in The Herald during the week about the various, I suppose, reasons behind Dublin's malaise. I mean, I guess we can call it a malaise.
Yeah, well, I suppose the point of the piece was trying to chart a line of reasoning through Dublin's league campaign. And I suppose the deeper you got into it, the more you realised that it was actually just... like a series of random events, you know. I think the Tyrone performance and the Tyrone defeat coloured an awful lot of the analysis that followed. Yeah. Like, losing on the first day in Clonus isn't a big deal. They weren't back very long. They didn't have the required levels of fitness. That's not a big deal. Losing by a point in Tralee isn't a big deal either. But I think the thing that's remarkable insofar as it's a break from previous years was that Tyrone performance happened in Croke Park at a time of the league when traditionally they have actually been accelerating towards summer. And even the subsequent performance in Cavan was very flat, albeit they won the game pretty comfortably in the end. So if you go through it, like the problem is there's any number of ways to interpret it. Like if you said that one of Dublin's main players was out of form, you say, okay, well, that's a cause for an alarm. Yeah. But if all their main players aren't being consistent, then you say, well, then there's something collectively behind that. You know, there's some level of training that's going on that doesn't actually permit them to produce their best stuff. And like, if you go through a lot of the older players that are over 30, Michael Darmacauley, Paul Flynn, Bernard Brogan, Kevin McManaman, Philly McMahon, even Stephen Cluxon, who only started two games, they got very limited game time in the league. So you can say, well, these guys are at a stage in their careers where it's the law of diminishing returns. You know, they can't contribute to the same. But if you look at it another way, you say, well, these guys have an awful lot of mileage on their legs. This is the bench. These are the finishers. And Jim Gavin wants to keep them very fresh for what would be a very unique summer. So it's impossible to make any very real conclusions about this.
Since you've said it, what is your conclusion? What happens here? Because, I mean, like, the beauty that Dublin have, I suppose, that a lot of other counties maybe don't have, particularly the ones that are going for, that see themselves in with a shot of winning the All-Ireland. And by the way, Dublin still are absolutely clear odds-on favourites to win this thing. And I think Kerry may be second at 4-1, something like that. So there is, people still clearly feel Dublin are going to win this. And the advantage they have, obviously, is a bit of a soft run-in with Leinster before they actually hit the meat, probably in mid-July.
Yeah, well, sort of always maintained that this year wasn't really about Dublin so much as all the teams that could potentially beat them. You know, like they won last year at a canter, but... like, Mayo never made it to the Super 8s. Kerry never got out of the Super 8s. Tyrone threw up a pretty meek performance in the All-Ireland final. And this year, I think all the main contenders, those three teams, Galway, and I'd actually include Donegal in that. I saw Donegal in the Division 2 final. I think they could be dark horses. They have an awful lot of the things that you need to be All-Ireland contenders. And if they're not this year, they certainly will be next year if they keep going. But I think the group of teams around Dublin have all improved in a very, very obvious way. I think, like, Mayo have found a couple of players and they are, I know it's a very basic way of looking at it, but they look rejuvenated. They've won a national title. Yeah. There's a feel-good about them. They don't look as weary and lethargic as they did maybe in their final year under Stephen Rochford. Kerry have gone a new direction completely, and they're going to make very serious ground on Dublin very quickly. Whether that's enough to actually catch them this year, I couldn't be certain either way, and I don't think anybody possibly can. And I think the change in style from Tyrone makes them a really, really dangerous prospect as well. Yeah. So if nothing else, I think we'll have a very exciting Super 8 and an exciting conclusion to the All-Ireland Senior Football Championship. But the point you make about Dublin having a very soft opening is absolutely valid.
And I think looking at it, it seems like the teams have got close, that Dublin have definitely slipped back a bit, whether that's a temporary thing, and they ultimately... Like, we look back at that in September and go, Jesus, what were we on about? How did we not spot that they were building for this thing? So maybe that's a thing, but it doesn't, certainly at this point of the year, looks as if things have just concertinaed in a small bit, that Mayo have stepped up a bit, Kerry are a little bit further down the route, Dublin have stepped back a small bit, as you say, Tyrone have maybe moved on a bit. Just that it feels a bit closer. Like, at this stage last year, we were looking at it going, there's only one winner here.
Yeah, I think it's this. I don't think Dublin would be any lesser a team than they were last year, but I think to win the All-Ireland this year, they might have to be a better team than they were last year, which it's not easy to do either, you know. Yeah. But I suppose what defines that team is, you know, in every tight situation they've been put in, predominantly by Mayo, but also by Kerry on a couple of occasions, they've produced.
Managed to find a way.
And key to that are their key players, you know, like Brian Fenton, James McCarthy, Johnny Cooper, the guys who make the team tick. And I think, you know, Stephen Cluxton and Kieran Kilkenny are in that bracket as well. And if those guys keep fit for the summer, if they find form, like, it's going to take a serious effort from any of those rivals to beat Dublin.
Yeah, roll on the championship. So we leave our Dublin chat for the minute. Tom Malone's in studio next. He's going to talk us through all the this morning's sports news. But first up, Johnny Ward on the week in Irish football.
If you look at Brexit, and we're kind of having a bit of a laugh over here at the British, how much of a mess they've made of Brexit. Anyone British looking in yesterday, not only at the FAI, but at some of the politicians there, would have a laugh at us. I was ashamed to be Irish yesterday, some of the things that happened. It was an absolute joke. And what Michael Healy Ray did, how anyone could elect somebody like that. and with the votes he gets, he wasn't even on the committee and he came in there.
Typical blue tick Dublin media having a go at Michael Healy Ray again.
It was shameful stuff start to finish. And fair play to some of the journalists, because I know one or two of them were asked at the infill, how do you think we're getting on? And they were told, not very well, actually. And in the second half, they came out the second half, even though the former CEO decided that he wasn't going to turn out on the pitch for the second half. He'd said 4 minutes in the first 4 hours, at least the politicians came out in the second half, particularly Jonathan O'Brien, who's ex-Cork City, and basically showed them for the people that they are, you know. And it was good TV, but it was disgusting what went on.
All right, do keep your comments coming in. Plenty on the back of that Dublin stuff, including the usual stuff, Conor. You'd be delighted to hear from one here on YouTube, Dara Toole. How about Mayo and Kerry get 10 million each next year and the year after to try and even up the championship with Dublin?
What would they spend it on?
I don't know. Parachuting in, like, I don't know. It's the thing of nothing. It's the thing that people generally tend to say off the back of conversations about Dublin, that it's an unfair playing field. And to be fair, I suppose there is some element of that that's probably reasonable enough. Tom, good morning to you.
Hi, guys.
Golf is...
We'll start with the golf. Start with the golf. Three-time major winner Brooks Koepka holds a share of the lead. He was the only player to go bogey-free in shooting a 6-under par opening round of 66 at Augusta.
Probably the best ball striking round I've had in a major championship, I would say. I left myself with a lot of good looks. Hit a lot of good putts, just didn't make too many. You know, kind of fell in love with the line there on 16, and you know, 18 actually hit a good putt, just didn't drop. So I was very impressed with putting the ball in the fairway.
He's joined at the top of the leaderboard by fellow American Bryson DeChambeau. He ended his round with three successive birdies there to join Koepka at the summit of the leaderboard. Good round for Phil Mickelson as well. He finished on 5-under par with a 67. Also, Ian Poulter and Dustin Johnson just behind there on 4-under par. Rory McIlroy's chances of completing that career Grand Slam, they took a dent, particularly those bogeys on 17 and 18 undoing. Good work earlier in the round with birdies on 13, 15 and 16 getting him into contention, but he finished on 1-over par. He wasn't delighted with his putting or the greens.
The greens they're not very fast for Augusta, so I think that's thrown a few people off. When they're fast, they break more, and you know, I overread a couple early on, and then you sort of read less into them later, and then they start to break a bit more, so just a little bit of that.
Yeah, well, fairly classic McIlroy round as well, wasn't it? Like, I didn't watch all of it, but I did pick it up. He started to get a bit of a run on with about four holes to go. Typical classic McIlroy.
Just sitting there looking at and walking off 16, you're going, here you go now.
Yeah.
Just one birdie, these last two holes, and you're bang in contention.
He was one under par at that stage.
Yeah, and he bogeys both of them. Yeah.
I saw a statistic yesterday, 74% of Masters champions are in the top 10 after day one. So,
yeah, and it's and very
I don't think any in the last decade, roughly, that have finished outside the top 10 after the opening day. The champion has always been in the top 10 after the opening day. So
yeah, you'd imagine. So Shane Lowry looks like he can make alternate weekend plans anyway. He shot a 78 yesterday. On to football in the Europa League last night. There are wins for Arsenal and Chelsea in their quarterfinal first legs. Gunners beat Napoli 2-0 at home. Ramsey with the opener, and then Koulibaly turned the ball into his own net. Well, Marcus Alonso scored late to give Chelsea a 1-0 win in Slavia Prague. That game, though, overshadowed by racist incidents with Chelsea fans. In the other quarterfinal, Valencia got the better of Villarreal, 3-1 in the all-Spanish affair. Well, in the other one, this the most interesting thing of the night, arguably, the emergence of new potential star João Felix. He got himself a hat-trick in Benfica's 4-2 win over Eintracht Frankfurt, and there's no doubt that he's going to dominate all the transfer speculation over the course.
This was the lads on their junket over in Portugal last year. Tommy, was that when you entered that junket? Yeah. And it was around the time that João Felix was signing, is that right?
Yeah, he announced his
contract.
And he had an enormous buyout clause written into his contract as well. So we don't know exactly what it is.
But important shots, yeah,
absolutely. And he's already been linked to the likes of Real Madrid, Juve, Manchester City. 100 mil plus price tag been touted. And no harm either. Shares an agent with Cristiano Ronaldo and Jorge Mendes there. So that won't do his chance any harm of being enormously rich by this time next year. League of Ireland tonight. Shamrock Rovers, an 8-point lead at the top of the SSE Electricity Premier Division. They host Waterford in Talla later. Greg Bulger expected to shake off a knock and start for the Hoops. Second place Bows make the trips all the way up to Finn Harps there, who are at the bottom. Of course, they've just 2 points from their opening matches. Cork City, they host Pats, while reigning champions Dundalk go to Sligo Rovers. And UCD, who beat Waterford last time out, welcome Derry to Belfield. In the Premier League tonight, Brendan Rodgers, Leicester will look to continue their good run of form. They're up to seventh at the moment. Brilliant run of form under Rodgers, with a win over Newcastle. Magpies, by the way, without an away win in the Premier League since the middle of December. Kickoff there at 8 o'clock. And in rugby, Ulster can seal their place in the Guinness Pro 14 playoffs with a win over Edinburgh tonight. Henderson has recovered from injury to skipper Dan McFarlane's side, while Jacob Stockdale has been picked at fullback. He played there for Ireland under-20s, actually, with a Heineken Champions semi-final on the line. Munster, by the way, have arrested several frontline players for the trip of informed Benetton for that one, and Reds head coach Johan van Graan has been assessing tonight's opponent.
They've got a very physical back of forwards that can mix it with any back of forwards in the Pro 14. Those two wingers of theirs, they are very fast and very powerful. So, well-balanced side. I think they've won something like 10 out of their 12 last home games. They're also playing for a Pro 14 playoff spot. So, great challenge for Munster going down there on Friday night.
Yeah, of course, Benetton got that draw last week against Leinster. Yeah. Pretty spectacular, what, 82nd minute by when went over in the corner and then slotted it. So, look, Benetton are banging form. That's intriguing. But also got the snooker as well. Dream scenario for Ross Bullman this afternoon. 17-year-old from Yall faces Jimmy White in the qualifiers for the World Championships. So you imagine, oh no, at 17 is even too young to remember Jimmy White.
Definitely.
He's like, who is
it's
this
great,
little guy?
Isn't it? Yeah. Tom, thanks a million for that. We will be talking, picking up that point about Jacob Stockdale at 15 for Ulster this weekend. We've Alan Quinlan in studio next to discuss all the rugby, but we mentioned Tommy and Owen's junkets. They were offering another one during the week. You may have heard we've got a brand new Game of Thrones podcast here on Off the Ball. It's called Off the Wall, Badoom-tish, and you can find it on our YouTube and our podcast as well. The whole USP, Tommy writes here. Tommy really has jumped the fence here in terms of everything he's up to this week. The whole USP of the podcast, Tommy tells me, is that Andy Lee is at the heart of it and he's absolutely obsessed by Game of Thrones. So we sent Sue along with Owen, Tommy and Andy up north this week, and they caught up with the Irish actor Liam Cunningham, or to give him his real name, Sir Davos.
Thank you very much. Tell us about your time playing Sir Davos. You know, how he developed from like this kind of secondary character, now he's the main, one of the main men.
Well, you know what? I think the producers got to like him because there's so much. I use the term moral ambiguity in this. In other words, there's some bad swines in this show, right? And they kind of needed something. I mean, he's been described as the moral compass of the piece, you know. And I always think he spoke up for the audience.
Yeah,
that's how I felt about him, that he was kind of going, you can't do this madness, this is bad, whatever you're trying to do.
There's been several times in the show when you've made huge speeches to the Iron Bank, to the Northerners, behalf of Kings, that really swayed it, wasn't it?
He speaks the truth, and he speaks simply, you know, and he's from a very humble beginnings, but he's never overwhelmed by any of this. He's only overwhelmed when people want to do the wrong things for what they think is the right reasons. And, you know, that kind of holds the mirror up to society in a way, you know what I mean?
How do you think he will react when he sees, if he sees, Melisandre again? You'll be doing a bit of boxing yourself.
I might be coming out of retirement myself.
Tell me, you said he's not a fighter, you know, he's... He said himself, I'm not a fighter, but will he see any action, do you think, in Season 8?
I'm hearing rumours there might be a lot of action in Season 8. Anything more than that, I'd have to kill both of us.
Liam, thanks very much.
Nice talking to you.
Pleasure, thank you.
Yeah, I wouldn't fancy his chances, Liam. I mean, you know, in character or out of character against Andy Lee. Wouldn't fancy your chances. Bonus episode will drop today before the 8th and final season of Game of Thrones returns this Sunday, April 14th. You can follow @offthewall_GOT on Twitter and on Instagram. And two massive Game of Thrones fans in studio alongside me this morning. Alan Quinlan, good morning to you.
Good morning, Adrian. How
We've all just been discussing what's going to happen in the final series. Like, will Sir Davos take the Iron Throne, or... You know, they would sort of the ice knight come down and behead everybody. The two of you haven't you.
We were chatting away there, yeah. I know like nothing about it. Connor knows everything.
Actively
about
dislike it, Connor?
Actively dislike it, yeah.
What's your beef?
Well, I gave it a chance because people were. I tend to not watch programs that people say are great. So
right.
I watched The Wire five years after everybody's. It's just a stubborn thing. I can sit there and say, you can't be right about this. So I watched The Wire 5 years after everyone and said that I'm very, very stupid. I should have watched this. How has this been missing in my life? So recently they said, right, I give Game of Thrones a go, and I couldn't get past it.
Started from season one.
Yeah, it's rubbish.
Wow. Yeah. I literally never heard anybody say it's rubbish. Why do you dislike it?
I don't watch fantasy programs. It's kind of softcore porn with a bit of fantasy mixed in. It just doesn't do it for me.
Right.
I'd be listening to the
it's
podcast.
It's pretty ruthless. Like it's ruthless with its characters. Obviously, it's one of the main things that, you know, you're like getting heavily invested in Sean Bean or whoever it is, and before you know it, he's...
Come on, get on to a bit of sport. I don't know what you're talking about.
There's a podcast about it. You can listen to it.
There is. It's actually excellent. I highly recommend it, so do check it out. Right, time to talk rugby, and Quinny, good weekend to get into, and we'll talk about some of that in a few minutes, but the comments of Israel Folau, obviously Folau, have dominated a lot of the rugby headlines this week. He's had various meetings, it seems, with Rugby Australia. There are all indications from them so far that on the back of these homophobic comments, which we're not going to repeat, the lads were chatting about them during the week, they're not, in my view, worth repeating. They exist, and people, I'm sure, will be aware of them at this stage. What happens here?
Well, Rugby Australia, in fairness, you've got to applaud them for their stance and the way they reacted very, very quickly. This is the second time it's happened. He did it last April as well. And it got a lot of attention.
Mm.
And a lot of top rugby players at the time condemned what he said and disagreed what he said. And I do as well, and I did at the time, and I do now, and I think the same reaction, it's been a stronger reaction from the rugby community, if you like. The worrying thing here is there's been a lot of likes to his posts, which, you know...
Some of them from other high-profile rugby
players.
Yeah,
Naholo, Maseli Naholo, the New Zealander, liked it. Francis Saili liked it, but clarified that it was a mistake, really quickly afterwards, and you've got to take him for his word at that. I'm not sure what other rugby players have liked it, but
it seems like such a forthright thing to have said and then to jump in and like it, you know.
It's like who the hell is Israel Folau to tell people that they're going to hell, that just because he believes it, because he's read it in a book somewhere? It's absolute bullshit. And I met the guy last summer in Australia, and seemed like a very nice guy. He was very open. I interviewed him, really polite. He seemed good with all the kids around after the game, standing in for photos, very, very polite to everyone. But, you know, he's telling people they're going to hell for all these sins. It's not his job to start preaching that rubbish to people, and you know, people should be allowed to be who they are. We're all sinners, probably, you know, in the eyes of our Lord. But you
well,
know,
yeah, and his version of a sin is,
well, you're going to hell if you sin, and that's not what I've been taught in.
Well, I take issue with his, his version of what a sin actually is. Like, rugby obviously has an opportunity, Quinny, to do something here, right? Like, they have an opportunity to take a stance against one of the most high-profile international players in the game right now. Do you think they take that? I mean, as a game?
I think here, the issue here is freedom of speech and all that is fine, but if you're employed by someone and you're representing not just his own people in Australia and the Waratahs, but essentially he's representing everybody who plays the code of rugby union. And to be fair, we can all talk about values and good values and stuff like that, but I 99.9% of people, I think, in rugby would think that this is discrimination against people who want to be themselves, who want to live a normal life, who've probably been through incredible trauma to maybe, you know, find out who they are and the struggles they've had with their sexuality. And here's a guy who people look up to, who go to a stadium and cheer him on. And I'm sure there's loads of Australian gay people who go and support rugby and love rugby. And of course they should be entitled to go and have their day out and enjoy the fun and be normal like everybody else.
And unless Rugby Australia take that stance, so they won't feel that.
But here's one of their heroes saying, well, you're going to hell. You're not welcome here. You're not welcome in sport. You're a sinner. You're going to hell. If you believe that, fine, believe that, but shut your bloody mouth and don't use a massive social media platform only because he's an international sports person. If he was a normal person, he might have 500 people or 1,000 people. He's a couple of 100,000 people following him on Instagram and social media. I don't agree with it, and I saw a great tweet from Carl Ferns, English rugby player, who said, well, if Israel Folau is going to heaven, I'm out.
I'm
no
grand.
Thanks for me. Because, you know, like, who's he to judge? Who's he to be telling people that they're going to hell in a very strong, condemning way? You have a few pints? Were you ever drunk?
Me?
Yeah.
Occasionally.
You're going to hell, according to Israel Folau.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Mm.
It's absolute bullshit, like.
Mm.
We want to live our lives well, and I respect everybody's religion and their beliefs, and, you know, their cultures and all that kind of stuff. And but, like, here's a guy who's using a platform to tell the world, go and preach it you know, around Australia if he wants, and let someone else report on it. But using the social media platform, and he's discriminating.
Well, in his
people.
Position, he can't even do that, because, I mean, he shouldn't be doing that. It's his position is the thing. And
yeah, and I don't want to create any hate or anger towards him. Listen, I just think it's frustrating, and I feel for people. I know lots of gay people, and, you know, I've relations who are in that situation. So it's something that, you know, it's unfortunate that he's gone and done it again. He believes this stuff so strongly that he doesn't care about his job, really. And he's kind of going, well, you know, the Lord's way and the Lord's path and all that kind of stuff. But he's thrown away a good, perfectly good, a brilliant rugby career here. It's 4 or 5 months before a World Cup. I'm sure Michael Checa is freaking out with this, that it's happened again. Should he play again? Rugby Australia have said, basically, unless there's mitigating factors here and he does a reverses very, very aggressively and very, very quickly, that they don't see any other way than to terminate his contract. The NRL have said that they're not going to touch him. Yeah. The AFL, maybe he's played that before, maybe they'll take the same stance. I think they do. This is for the greater good of inclusivity in our communities.
Great message.
That people, whether no matter what sexuality, no matter what religion you are, you can play sport, you can be included, you can be a normal person, you can live your life freely. And here's a guy who's saying, well, there's a list of things there, we won't read them out, as you said, that you're going to hell. So he's frightening people who are struggling, and that frustrates and annoys me. That's what he's trying to preach and tell me as someone who's been involved in rugby all my life. He's using that platform to tell people that they're going to hell, and that's upsetting and disturbing for people who are struggling, and a lot of people who are afraid to come out and reveal their sexuality. And you know, the world is changing around that, and I think that's a brilliant thing. So should Rugby Australia keep him? I'm not sure there's any way back here, because
the post is still alive. He hasn't doesn't feel strongly enough about
I think they
it.
Should sack him.
Second time
they,
it's happened.
I think they should either suspend him or sack him. Look, I wouldn't sack him if he says, look, I'm sorry, I believe in this stuff, but I'm sorry, and I've used the platform here, and it's, you know, he's got to come out. And
isn't that a cop-out, though?
It is ultimately a cop-out, yeah. And will it be seen as, look, just being done to save a World Cup place here and keep him involved in the rugby union? This is going to follow him everywhere from now on. And maybe he's happy with that. Some reporter approached him in Sydney Friday midday and asked him, was he sorry about the post? And he said no. Right, and he jumped into his car. So, look, I don't want to, like, it's very frustrating. He was really nice to me, and he did an interview, and I thought he was a lovely bloke, and it was a little bit after that. And I didn't go in there because it was straight after the first test in Brisbane. But I think he's wrong, and he's been a bigot here with this stuff. And I just want to say, whether my voice is, has any meaning to anybody else, than anybody out there who's struggling around their sexuality, don't believe the bullshit that Israel Folau has put up on his social media posts, because the vast majority of people don't believe that. And be who you want to be, live your life as best you can as a good person, not being judged by someone who believes that crap.
He was, Ger pointed out in the show during the week as well that it's, and we'd leave it on this, but it doesn't deserve any more conversation. He previously had been a poster boy for the LGBT community in, you can see the photograph there on your screen, in Australia, and had sort of lent his weight behind that community, which makes it even more bizarre that, as Ger pointed out, a good point well made, that something in his life has changed, and now we have to listen to this guff. So anyway, look, we're going to leave that there. Munster tonight, they're off to Benetton. We've been discussing a little bit earlier that Benetton obviously in good form. They dug it out against Leinster last weekend. Hodgepodge side for Munster tonight.
Yeah, it's a weaker side, and Johan van Gran has made that decision. And you know, I spoke earlier in the week about if it was my choice, I would have tried to gone as strong as I could there. But look, there is a bigger picture here, and the bigger picture is Saracens next week, and you've got to rely on squad depth. And maybe if you played a full strength side tonight, that their minds would have been, might have drifted towards next week, and some guys might have been minding themselves and the travel, all that kind of stuff. So, you know, to be fair, you've got to trust the coach. It mightn't work out for him.
No.
Benetton have made one change. They've all their Italian internationals playing. They got a great result in Dublin last week. So it's a real test for this Munster side now, and there's a lot of guys there who will be chomping at the bit to try and prove a point, and they're getting a responsibility. It's still a decent, very good team, but you're away from home. Here's a team that's you know, sitting third in the playoff positions of Conference B. They've won 10 games. They've lost 7, 2 draws. It's remarkable, and it's brilliant to see them right up there. So they're, you can imagine their determination and their desire to try and win tonight, which would effectively, you know, keep him in the hunt going into the last weekend and keep in a very strong position of finishing third and being in the playoffs and being in Europe next year, Adrian, which is massive. So it's a tough task, but the risk maybe the risk of getting guys injured.
Normally going to Italy throughout your second team, everything will be grand. It's just the difficulty being that they're trying to lock down their spot.
And that's good. It's good that it's different, isn't it?
Yeah.
And even Zebre, even though they haven't won, you know, they're bottom of Conference A. They've only won 3 games and lost 16, but they've been far more competitive. The games that Zebre have lost even some of them on the road have been very encouraging. So that's the whole reason why the Italian's there, and everybody wants them to improve in the Pro 14, and it's brilliant. And there's a lot of good structures, and there's a lot of good players coming through. So that's good to see, but it's a challenge. That's a tough challenge for them. Connacht, they play Cardiff. They have a chance to guarantee playoffs. If they win there, they can't be caught then by Cardiff at the weekend. And Glasgow, Munster will be looking for Leinster to do them a favour.
Yeah.
It's like something that'll happen now, that Munster will lose to Benetton and Leinster will do them the favour. It won't matter because... Yeah. I think it'll be back in, but Glasgow, look, it's in their hands. If they get something in Dublin, get a win in Dublin, they're home to Edinburgh the following week, which they've lost to twice already. Edinburgh are very strong this year, but you know, it's Munster have taken that gamble, and maybe
we'll only know once it happens. One of the most interesting selections for me for the weekend was for that you mentioned Edinburgh Ulster tonight. Jacob Stockdale, 15 for Ulster, played there for Ireland under 20s. Is this Joe Schmidt looking at everything that's gone on over the last couple of months and made a little quiet call to Dan McFarland and said, "Listen, I need some backup here. Put him in."
I'm not sure, but look, he played so well for Ireland in the 2016. Under 20s when they got to the final, and he's multi talented. He can do that.
Was
no
he?
Problem.
Do you know? Was he playing there regularly at that time, or was that a stopgap?
No, he's played a couple of times there for Ulster, but he's played in the under 20s at fullback and underage rugby at fullback. So it's something that for sure he can do. I think look, it's you go back to the Robbie Henshaw gamble or against England to see if we could kind of get some more depth at fullback, because
that prospect isn't done though, is it? Like, I mean,
no, it's not, and I wouldn't be against Robbie Henshaw going back there again. Ireland had a bad day at the office that day, and a lot of people focused on maybe the gamble at fullback and stuff like that. But the more guys you can get to play there who have that versatility in the back three, brilliant. He has a big boot at the ball. He's a left peg as well. And he's very strong and physical. You know, it takes a bit of time, and the way the game has gone with the kicking trend in rugby, the aerial battles are vital. And you know, Rob Kearney, that's why he keeps coming back, and people keep talking about, and he keeps responding to some criticism at times about his attacking game. He's so good in the air, and it'll be interesting to see how Stockdale goes. And again, it's 6 months out from World Cup. If he has a run at full back, it's another option for Joe Schmidt.
Defence is obviously the thing that we assume is his biggest weakness, obviously, which is kind of surprising
And it's not the physicality or the ability. It's sometimes the read from a wing, from the wing, or his positional sense at times, where you know we've seen him get a lot of intercept tries and stuff like that. It's a different type of defending. You're kind of last man as a full back at times, and So, it'll be interesting. I think he has a capability. He's a very, very talented player, and, you know, hopefully he'll respond. I think they had a bit of a hangover last week, Ulster, when they went to Glasgow and got well beaten. So it's another tough one back in Edinburgh tonight for them, and they've got to try and get a result there, because they've Leinster at home the last week, and I wouldn't, you know, that's a tough ask at home, even though Leinster would be qualified and you know, so getting something done tonight for Ulster will be really important. Okay. And like I said last week, hopefully we'll have four Irish teams in the playoffs.
Any big predictions for next week?
The big predictions for next week? God, it's a bit of time out. Yeah, look, it depends. You know, Carberry probably won't make it at this stage. And I think, you know, Munster will back Tyler Blaindell. And I think it's going to be very difficult for him. There's no doubt about that. It depends what kind of side Saracens have as well, but they have a lot of depth and strength. And
nobody'd be talking about the Munster winning it, which is maybe the best position for Munster.
Mark McCall would be very conscious of that, and they came to Dublin 2 years ago, and there was a real kind of rally and cry for Munster in Dublin, and it'd be, you know, it just didn't work. Saracens control that game. They're an exceptionally good side, and that's the reality of it. And you know, so it'll be a very tough task. But look, they'll be fresh, they'll be ready, and I think, you know, they'll be less expectation for him to win this one, and that could make him very, very dangerous. They need to get a 9 or 10 out of 9 out of 10 from everyone across the board and stop Saracens at source, but they're a very good side. For Toulouse then, Leinster, you know, I said in round 5 I thought Toulouse could go to Dublin and upset them, so they didn't, but they've kind of found their mojo again after that. So that'll be an interesting one on Sunday, but I think it'll be a Saracens Leinster final, I think.
Right.
I hope I'm wrong. It'd be brilliant if it was a Munster Leinster final. It'd be incredible. You can imagine the scenes in Newcastle, and our little wager on it then, myself and yourself.
What are we? Oh yeah. What, I mean, I'd take on some of that action.
You'd have to give me some.
Not at all. Go out of that. Sure. I mean, you'd surely back your team. You don't need odds. You'd surely back your team.
Oh, you're the champion, right? Sir.
You have little time to catch up on 7 seasons of Game of Thrones. But are you going to start watching it at all? At any point?
Well, not after it's what Connor said. No.
I thought that would have.
No, I'm not.
Israel Folau is not going to be watching Game of Thrones anytime soon. It strikes me that ticks a lot of those boxes on his list.
Maybe he'll be in Game of Thrones next, because he mightn't be playing rugby for a while.
For the chap. Quinny, thanks, William, for coming in. Enjoy your weekend. That's Alan Quinlan, all the weekends, rugby and more as well. We're going to be talking Masters next here on OTBAM with John Duggan en route. Just a reminder, too, that you can listen to the show every morning, of course, on offtheball.com, just like a breakfast sports radio show. You just hit listen on the site, minimise, and go about your morning, commute, whatever it is you're up to. If you're driving on the bus to Lewis and you just can't watch us, then that is the way to do it. So go to offtheball.com and click on the giant big listen button right there up in the top right. So Tiger Woods got everyone excited yesterday. Here's Shane Ryan, the author of Slaying the Tiger. He was chatting to Nathan last night about his chances of winning another major.
Yeah, there's 86 others with a shot. So probably one of them will, but who knows? Maybe this will be his week.
Yeah, it is the perfect start, though, from a storyline point of view, to have Tiger right there. And I don't know how much of a surprise this is, considering Augusta is the type of course where form and knowing how to get it around is so important. And he was leading on the final day of the Open last year. He's won a PGA Tour event. His comeback is well underway. But he's shown little or nothing so far this season. And the weight of history, the weight of expectation. Are you surprised to see him up there so early on day one?
Not necessarily, no. I think, like you said, familiarity is important at Augusta, and this is probably the most likely, if Tiger's ever going to win another major, it's going to be this one. And he's probably going to have his best days early on, which isn't to say that he couldn't also play great on the weekend and actually contend. But I think if you said, you know, when is Tiger going to be near the leaderboard at what major, it would be Thursday at Augusta. But again, this is a place where even in his darkest days, he competed and he contended. So it's not only knowing the course, but he likes the course, and he's always liked the course. You know, he didn't know the course in 1997, and he did pretty well that year too. So it's could be Tiger's year for sure. I wouldn't bet on it, but it could be.
Yeah, that is Shane Ryan on Tiger Woods, who sits on 2 under par after the opening round of the Masters on after his 70 yesterday. It's Bryson DeChambeau and Brooks Koepka leading the way, who both fired 66s yesterday for 6 under, 1 clear Phil Mickelson, and then a further shot back to Ian Poulter and Dustin Johnson. So pretty stacked leaderboard, John Duggan. Good morning to you.
Adrian and Connor, how are you doing?
Good. That is, there's one stat about, was the last 13 champions have ended day one in the top 10, and you could see with other players like Adam Scott and John Rahm not a million miles away why that might continue in 2019.
Hard course to chase on, you know. It's a hard course to chase on because the quality, I think, of the field is a huge part of that. It hasn't been since 2005 that a player shot over par, Tiger Woods it was, and won the Masters. Mm-hmm. And Rory McIlroy has to battle that stat 14 years on. And he's already 7 off the players who won the last 2 majors, Brooks Koepka, US Open, USPGA. Bryson DeChambeau has won 5 times on the tour in the last 3 years. Phil Mickelson has won 3 Masters. Dustin Johnson is the second best player in the world. Yeah. He's won 20 times on the US Tour. Ian Poulter will give it everything. And then you got John Rahm and Adam Scott, as you say. So it's Ricky Fowler's in there on 2 under, Woods on 2 under, Molinari 1 under. I think it's about the quality of the fields, which makes it harder for people to chase at Augusta, especially if you've got in there late, which they did, and posted a good score. And then if you get out early in soft conditions, and then you can shoot, say, 68. So say Koepka shoots 68, he's 10 under par. McIlroy's in the last group today, teeing off at 7 o'clock Irish time. You're 11 shots off the lead. What does that do to you psychologically? Mm. you end up chasing it a bit, you end up pushing it a bit, and then you end up possibly making mistakes because you're not playing your own game, you're pushing a leaderboard.
And he's all over the place as well, Rory. Like, it is in some ways fairly classic Rory McIlroy that we tend to see. Sometimes he can be all over the place and still shoot a 600 par, but I started watching him last night on, it might have been 15, where he went left off the tee, was in behind the trees, horrific position to be in, and suddenly pulls out this amazing shot, has a putt for eagle, gets birdie, birdies the 16th, and you think suddenly, 100 par, the lead at that point was 300, you think, Jesus, he could match this. Bogey, bogey finish. And as you say, like, when you listen to Rory McIlroy during the week, he talks about all the mental game that he's been doing and the juggling and the meditation and all this stuff. The difficulty is when you start talking about that stuff and it doesn't work, where does he go from here?
Well, he talked himself into the green jacket. Like, he talked himself into the measurements, the way he was speaking at that press conference and the way he'd been playing so well. Best, hottest player in the world, won the Players' Championship. You're thinking, okay, he sorted out his head, and this is going to be a Rory that now gets over the line regarding this career Grand Slam. Brooks Koepka had no bogeys. Shambo had the last four holes he made birdies on. Woods only had one bogey. You can't make six bogeys at Augusta. You just can't. And expect to win the thing. You just can't. You can't have sloppy errors in what you're doing. And even from the first tee shot, a nervy opening tee shot that went off to the right. And to me, that's poor. Like, that's poor from somebody who should be just striping it down the middle. And maybe shooting, it would be much better for McIlroy to shoot 70 with just two birdies and no bogeys than to be shooting five birdies and six bogeys.
Yeah.
And he could shoot 64 today. It's not beyond the realm as a possibility, but he's immediately under pressure.
He's chasing all the way now.
And I think we've seen before when Spieth, when he won by that record total in, I think it was at 15, he was miles clear. I think he shot 66 and 64, and there's just too much quality at the top of the leaderboard. I think McIlroy's Masters is over now. And there's just too much quality at the top of the leaderboard. The classic cliche, you can not win it on the Thursday and the Friday, but you can lose it. Mm-hmm. I think he's lost it.
I think with the two at the head is in the lead, like Bryson DeChambeau, as everybody knows, very quirky kind of individual. But he's a winner, like he's a born winner, even from his amateur days. And a bit like Brooks Koepka, they've no scar tissue here. Like, but Koepka has won every major that he's contended for. I remember listening to Shane Ryan speaking after the PGA last year, and Koepka, who didn't even make Shane Ryan's book, which in 2014 was about who would be the next great golfer to succeed Tiger Woods. Like he mentioned 14, 15 young golfers: Rory McIlroy, Dustin Johnson, Jordan Spieth, all these guys. Koepka didn't make it. He was on the European tour. You know, he decided to go to Europe to try and cut it as a golfer. But he has won every major that he's contended for. They say this about Dustin Johnson, you know, that he doesn't have a heartbeat, that he hits a bad shot, but he can get over it that quickly. And I suppose the implication is nearly that Dustin is unaware of the magnitude of his mistake. Right. But like, Dustin Johnson was winning at a rate that Tiger Woods was winning at on the PGA Tour in 2016, 2017, and he's been in the final group in five majors and only won once. Koepka's different. Koepka looks like he's the sort of fella who could actually pull away from the field if he has a good day today, which buys into, I think, what John is saying about Rory McIlroy. He doesn't just have ground to make up on what he has already not shot. It's what Koepka can do from here on in. And if Koepka starts well today, it could be a big number after Friday.
Yeah, I see Johnson on 400 par. I always feel that, and he's somebody who's definitely got that capacity, I think, to kick on over the weekend. I've always felt that commentary on Dustin Johnson has been so unfair to him, that idea that he's on the tee and there's literally nothing going around in his head, that's the... Padraig Harrington has that theory about you're either uber... If you're really good, you're either uber intelligent or you're uber dumb, and that DJ fits that. I've always felt it's very unfair to him.
Yes, Dustin, he's been around quite a long time, and he's, what, 34 now? And I remember, like, the US Open that he lost, I think it was out in Washington State, the greens were awful, and I think he three-putted, and, last year Shinnecock was very windy, and he is a winning machine. He was one already in Mexico this year. I almost have felt that his game has not been suited to Augusta because of the way he hits the ball. He hits a cut. And I do think, just because somebody is, and I think as well with Brooks Koepka, people like are kind of going, well, Brooks Koepka is a bit dull. Maybe he's just quiet. Maybe he doesn't want to engage in the celebrity game with the media. And I do think there's a there's kind of sometimes whispering articles that you get in the press about Dustin Johnson and that kind of thing. And why would you want to be going and talking to the media if you're getting these whispering articles or these rumours and all this kind of thing going on? So, I do think it's unfair to somebody's talent. And I also think that human beings are not, as sports stars, are not all of them geared to be media performers like Tiger Woods, like Phil Mickelson, like Ricky Fowler. To have all their social media correct and everything is very entertaining and that. And I think sometimes we get spoiled by golf because you're generally played by quite, theoretical kind of thinkers.
Yeah.
Patrick Harrington being a very clear exponent, close to home of that. And I sometimes think we're spoiled. I mean, we get access to golfers that we wouldn't get really in other sports regarding their thoughts, regarding their the way they feel that they're doing 20-minute press conferences. You wouldn't see Premier League footballers doing that. Mm. And if they'd be doing it, they'd just say they'd be looking forward to the game. So, yeah, I do think that sometimes the Dustin Johnsons and Brooke Koepkas can be a little bit unfairly painted as dull or uninteresting or not in tune with the whole magnitude of the legacy of the game, or you know, you're expected to answer questions about what would it mean and Tiger and Jack and all that kind of thing. And I think they let their golf do the talking. You need to hit along at Augusta and you need to get in position, and there are two guys that, you know, the thing about it is one of them might start to falter over the next 3 days. Will both of them falter? Will Phil falter, possibly over four rounds at the age of 48? Tiger, I thought, I watched him on the kind of the red button yesterday and I thought he was a bit loose at times with his shots. He only made one bogey, but he was a little bit loose at times with his putts and his shots.
And he drove the ball very well early in the round in particular, and you're thinking, well, if this guy's in position off the tee, it's going to take a serious effort to beat him. But it was almost like he was playing a little bit safe after, on the second hole, he had an iron in on a par five. And he played the kind of downhill long iron right to left, but he played for the good miss, if you know what I mean. Right. He left himself in the bunker. Now he got up and down for the birdie, but on a Sunday you're taking that on and you're taking the risk of turning the shot over too much. It ends up in no man's land on the left and you drop a couple of shots. So what makes today really interesting, two things, is the fact that it's DeChambeau and Koepka at the leaderboard with a low score. It means that the idea of playing safely for 2 days is gone. You have to go and attack. Tiger Woods will have to attack today. Rory McIlroy will have to attack. Anybody that's not 3 under will have to go and attack whenever they get out on the course. The other thing is the chance of rain. Rain changes Augusta completely. Like in was it 2007, Zach Johnson won a very wet Augusta. A short hitter, but like the theory that a wet course suits the longer hitters because they carry the ball further off the tee, it doesn't check out in Augusta all the time because the par fives then become equalised and nobody's going for the green in two. So then the guys who make shots in the field are the fellas with the wedge in their hand, the fella who hits the best 90-yard shot, and that's not Rory McIlroy. It's somebody like Xander Schauffele or Brandon Grace or even Francesco Molinari. But as it happens, there are a lot of big hitters up the top of the leaderboard, and I don't think Brooks Koepka or Dustin Johnson would be too unhappy to see if things get a bit kind of moist in Augusta today, because the forecast over the next couple of days is, it looks like it will definitely rain one of the days, and today could be the kind of most interesting day. With it's almost like today is Saturday now, because there's a lot of movement has to happen in the field for people to have a shot by tomorrow morning.
The attack point is an interesting one, that they're so far up there that the rest of the field needs to get a bit of a move on. Shane Lowry is one of those players who is pretty much out of it now, 78. On day one, he's clearly doubting himself. Asked whether he could get back into it, "I don't know," he said. We spoke about the photograph that's on a lot of the newspapers this morning that speaks volumes about his mental position. You know, the body language, you can see the facial expression, it's exasperation. Vincent Hogan, the Irish Independent, is out there, a good paragraph about him here. Lowry's round amounted to a grim, monotone struggle that left him questioning the pressure he'd put on himself just to get to Augusta National, let alone navigate his way around the toughest country estate in golf.
Well, he hit it in the water on the easiest hole in the course, 13, kind of sums up his day. Only one birdie, the rest bogeys, and he's been trying a lot of drivers since he won in Abu Dhabi. And I'm not so sure if he's comfortable with his game or where it is. And as he said in the article, it can get away from you quite quickly, Augusta. You have to be precise around Augusta and you have to keep the ball in play. And I don't think it was one thing that derailed him yesterday. I think it was a host of things. And you just can't make seven bogeys around Augusta. And That's just the way it is. You disappointing performances like Matsuyama I would have expected to contend, and he's three over, and Patrick Reed, the defending champion, is one over par. Jordan Spieth seems to completely lost it. He can't hit the ball straight, and he's got the yips. Justin Rose didn't have a great day. So if it doesn't, if you can let it get away from you, Augusta. You have to be in a degree of equilibrium with your game. And we saw Brooks Koepka describing his round as the best ball striking round he's ever had in a major. There's just too much quality. And also the par five performance is a huge thing. Like with these big hitters, if they're playing the par fives well, they you know, they're picking up, say if you pick up three shots out of the four par five holes, then you maybe pick up another birdie or two, and then you might have a couple of bogeys. That's three under par. So John Rahm would definitely be still in the conversation as well on three under par. Adam Scott would be in the conversation as a previous winner. But Kevin Kisner has won recently. He's one of the players, I think you were talking about, Connor, one of those precision players if the weather turns the correct way. And Ricky Fowler. But I'd be very surprised if we're talking about if there's somebody we haven't talked about right now that's going to win the Masters on Sunday.
Yeah, I think it's going to be Koepka. And now it could be, like, he could go out today and have a very poor start. And, like, you know, until you bottle your first major, you haven't bottled a major yet. You know, so like, there is a chance that it could happen. But he was so cool in the PGA last year. And was in Bethpage when all around him there was chaos breaking out because Tiger was on a different hole and Tiger was getting into contention. And I think it would have been very easy to become distracted. But it wasn't just how long he hits it off the tee. His long irons were so straight and his putting was absolutely... Like, he's an aggressive putter as well, which in Augusta it can be hard to do because it's almost a psychological thing. You see somebody like Ricky Fowler or Brad Snedeker, they aggressively put...
It's very easy to knock it 3, 4, 5 more feet past.
Yeah, but Koepka, I think, is the sort of guy who will keep being aggressive on his putts. He won't let it... Like, people talk about McIlroy's putting being, you know, he's not a good enough putter to win in Augusta, but he's a streaky putter, and I don't think it's his putting that lets him down. It's his reaction to a bad missed putt. Mm. The second hole last year in the final round being the classic example.
Temperament. I think you're talking about temperament.
He stood up on the third tee with an iron then and put it into the trees, and you're just saying, well, hang on. Like, you still made birdie on two. You've made two shots on Patrick Reed. You're just so disappointed not getting the eagle that you've let it go to your head.
He did knock in a long one on 15 yesterday, and you're kind of looking at it going, if this works from this week.
Yeah, and it's too instant. Mm. It's too instant. It's too bad, as you're saying, about the next 10 minutes, rather than it being, okay, well, let's do these in quadrants, or let's do these, how do the six holes go?
Yeah.
Like, Brooks Koepka was tied 56 at the player. He's been nowhere since the PGA. Mm. And then he's coming out in a major and he's just turned it on. And as you say, he hasn't blown one yet. He's only 28. And
there was a story during the week, and I saw Brandon Chambly talking about it, that there was some story that Koepka had changed diet and he'd lost a lot of weight. I saw a picture of him there and he doesn't look like the sort of fellow who's going to downsize.
I heard the commentators talking about it in the coverage last night and I was kind of
speaking to the gym, Brooks Koepka.
Are we all getting a bit too excited about the day one leaderboard? Is this...
Yeah.
Are we going to be...
We've been in the now and it'll be like three of their new lads will be, you know, leading tonight.
Exactly.
But it'll be, you know, off the ball AM tomorrow, so we can't really...
No, we can't make it.
I think just the interesting part of it, just to top it off, is that usually on a day one leaderboard, there's one of those guys there and so is Fred Couples and Bernard Langer, but whereas this actually has the look of a Sunday leaderboard.
Yeah.
And when it starts to take shape that quickly, it's hard to imagine them all coming backwards.
No, some of them will, but some of them won't.
And Butch is back, the biggest news of the week. Butch Harmon is back behind the mic. Everybody's happy, makes everybody feel comfortable and homely and can put on the slippers for the weekend.
I do this for sport a lot. I turn down the TV sound and I just watch it.
Do you really?
I also
right?
watch the red button a lot.
Yeah.
So I found watching the Masters the last few years, like, you'd be watching the red button on the Sunday and or they have the 15th and 16th holes, utter peace, utter quiet, and then you get
you don't like the commentary teams. Or?
I sometimes it can be a bit grate a bit on my head. I like, because I whatever about my arrogance, whatever. I like to get my own opinion processed through my mind, and chopping and changing lads all the time and saying obvious things, and you know, oh well, I know that.
Yeah,
so
the other thing is, we all follow sport now on Twitter, and inevitably the live coverage isn't live. It's a few seconds delayed. So you're kind of saying, and then it switches over and then you see
there's
whatever.
The PGA Tour Twitter account are the worst for it.
Yeah, yeah.
They'll ruin the putt just for it. It's like, lads, Do you not understand? Hold tight here for a few seconds. Give us an opportunity to see this.
Also, I love Butch, but not every ex-golfer is a good commentator.
It's true. It's true.
Paul McGinley's good. Butch is good, but not everyone is, you know, is good. And sometimes some of these people, I don't want to hear them. And it's not disrespect. I just don't want to. I don't want to hear like I turn down football commentary as well for the same reason.
Yeah, yeah, right.
You know, and
this is going to be a longer conversation, John. Yeah, I do appreciate yeah. this. We are coming back to this.
Even when I look back and off the ball, I am. I'll be doing like it's like Butch when the other Butch looks at the camera. I'll be like looking back now. This item I did in the Masters and looking without the sound. I'll be looking at the sound.
Well, my problem with Butch is that he is actually coaching some of the guys that are contending, and he
is that a conflict?
Yeah, it is a conflict, but he won't, like, he, you know that he knows what's going on with their swing, you know he knows what they've tweaked, and he kind of refuses to divulge any time. And when you know that, the stuff he says about those golfers annoys you, like, mm-hmm. you know, because you can tell that he's talking around the thing that he should be talking about. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely. That point exists in all sports, isn't it? It can be infuriating at times. Everybody's been slammed this morning. Commentators getting slammed. Game of Thrones getting slammed. Nobody's safe.
Sound. The whole concept of sound being slammed.
John, we are coming back to that conversation, by the way, just so you know. Thanks, William, for coming in.
All right, guys. Cheers. Pod.
And lots of coverage of the Masters, obviously, and off the ball across the weekend. And if you want to get a wrap, if that hasn't fully sated your appetite, there's lots more golf coverage up on offtheball.com as well, including last night's chat with Shane Ryan that you can go up and check out as well. So, Conor, thanks, William, for coming in. We still have a little bit to go, but you're going to leave us. So thanks, William, for coming in. Enjoyed your company this morning. Conor McKeown from the Herald and from the Irish Independent as well. We do want to bring you an interview that we carried out at the Aviva Stadium during the week. It was the Irish rugby and basketball star and also a former All-Ireland winner with Dublin, no less, Lindsay Peat. She spoke to us about the LGBT inclusivity and the state of women's sport in Ireland at the launch of the Union Cup, which is Europe's largest LGBT inclusive rugby tournament. Takes place in Dublin in June, and it's supported by Vodafone Ireland. Take a look. Lindsay, we're here obviously at the launch of Union Cup 2019. Very exciting day and huge amount of positivity in the room just now. And I'm going to ask you the same question that I asked you inside. What?
Yeah.
Tell me about the importance of Union Cup 2019 to the LGBT community in Ireland.
Well, as an openly gay international rugby player, for me to see that we have now Europe's largest gay inclusive tournament coming to Ireland for the first time. 45 teams, 15 countries, and we're leading the way through the form of sport and the sport of rugby to show the world what we can do and how we can host, and that we host it for everybody. Like, these are non-professionals. It's all well and good making bids for World Cups and hosting World Cups. We have to, you know, get behind those who are at the game from a lower level and a grassroots level, and say that sport is for all, and sport brings everyone together and great joy, and that's what, you know, the message is about.
I was surprised to read a piece of research. It was from the UK in the lead into this, and I know that the guys inside said there's going to be another piece of research in an Irish context, which,
yes,
I'm sure is hugely important, but surprised to see that the over 80%, I think, for both gay men and gay women, the level of homophobic insults that they were still subject to. Is that something that, are you surprised by that at all, or have you experienced?
Yeah, I am still surprised at it, but, you know, at the end of the day, we all know or have experienced bullies on some small or huge level, and people like that who are, you know, want to hurt you, they'll hurt you where they know they'll hurt you most. And unfortunately, when you are openly gay or people know you're in the LGBT community, they will try and hit you where it hurts, and that's unfortunate that they would go to that level. But there are people out there who will, and but at the same time, we've seen it with Nigel Owens, we've seen it with Gareth Thomas. Hopefully, we there's other stories similarly, that when people are subject to that, that the world gets behind them and tightens that protection in front of them and forms a shield and says, no, that's not okay. And, you know, they're people at the end of the day, and, you know, you have to take them at face value. You need to judge the person for who they are and what they bring. Not anything to do with their personal life. So we want, you know, obviously it is an LGBT tournament, but it is open to non-LGBT teams. It's open to everybody. If it's your first time coming even to see rugby, come and visit it. You know, the North Side obviously historically hasn't been huge for rugby at regard schools and clubs comparative to the South Side of Dublin. So it's going to be held in DCU. So if you're around, come and have a glimpse and support. And there's nothing better running onto a pitch where you hear a load of fans roaring such positivity and urging you on, and that's what we want to create for this tournament as well.
The other thing that, and it seems like we're
as a country almost getting our stuff together when it comes to women in sport, which is, it's taken a while, but it seems like we are getting, we're in some sort of a path.
Yes.
And obviously there's going to be a women's cup separate in this one, which is, again, a huge step along that ladder.
Yes, and, you know, we're here to talk about equality. We're here from an LGBT angle, but for me to hear there was a dedicated women's tournament is huge because, again, I'm a very proud athlete who has played on elite level, but it has been all along through, you know, being an amateur really and working full time and relying on the goodwill of, you know, whether it be DCU or my club, Railway Union or DCU Mercy when I was there, or Dublin, to provide that professional and elite environment. I wouldn't have been able to do that. So, you know, it's important that it's not just words. Mm. You know, I'm tired of words. I want actions. And this was a huge statement to have a women's tournament. And, you know, I can't stress enough that, you know, when we strive for equality for women, whether at the workplace or sport, we need to, when it's open, and this tournament has been open, and we need people to get involved. We need to put our shoulder to the wheel and drive it forward and make sure that this isn't the only time that we've seen a dedicated women's tournament, that it continues all along every 2 years when the Union Cup is held.
Are we getting our stuff together is probably how I should have phrased that, as a country when it comes to women's sport?
We are in bits. We're saying the right things. Now we need to start doing the right things. You know, we can't try and compete with England and France unless we get money behind us, because we just can't compete. You know, we need to put those frameworks in place that, you know, our players can train professionally or semi-professionally to try and match the standards of those standard bearers in the women's game, such as England, France, USA, Canada, New Zealand. They're all going to play in the summer. Like, look how many games they're getting at an international level. They get to blood new players. They don't have to wait till the Six Nations to see how we go, and then you just don't have time to fix it. So, you know, that's not me focusing on the RFU at rugby, because they need a big sponsor on board. They need money to help us. And it's about everybody rolling in. And as I said, it's, you know, the goals and the words are fabulous, but I need stepping stones, and I need stepping stones towards actions to push this, you know. And
how far you mentioned the RFU and obviously the sponsors, because I think that might be one of the key parts to unlocking all of this.
Yes.
And there are some major blue chip brands obviously involved with Union Cup, which is great to see. But how far away then are we from, because I mean, I think if anybody pays any attention to what's happening in the women's game with the Six Nations, there has been a bit of regression over the last 3 years down to some of the reasons I think that you've mentioned.
Yep.
In terms of what's happening in England and France, how far are we here from getting to that level?
I think we're a little bit off. We are a little bit off. Like, when, you know, England have to be, this just didn't happen overnight. Say if we focus on the Tyrrells Premiership, this didn't happen overnight. The RFU, yes, there was uproar about them taking back the professional contracts, but they actually reinvested the money into the club game because they felt it was better spent there, and I think that was the right decision. They've obviously introduced the contracts again because hopefully the success has brought more revenue. Yeah. And more revenue to be invested and give back those contracts. So I mean, if we're talking about sponsors, we probably need a sponsor of the AIL. We need to look at the provincial structure, because they'll all have impact to feeding in, as we can see with the men's game. You know, you've schools rugby, you've colleges rugby, you've under-20s, you've a pathway. So now when we see the likes of Josh Van Der Veer and Dan Levy, who just didn't appear out of nowhere, they've been on a pathway, they've been on a journey, they've been on a development journey. So when they come up to international level and they get their chance in the Autumn Internationals, they're prepared, you know. And we've had crossover athletes, you know. But we have seen the likes of Leah Lyons from Menya Breen, who've played in Skibbereen and Highfield at a very young age. And you can see the skill, you know, the difference in the skill set. And you can see then Leah playing in Harlequins and Anna Kaplis. Now, we have to, you know, pay attention and give credit to the foundations that were laid here for them. But the fact that they're playing against internationally recognised players week in, week out. The lads had 18 Premiership games, which they're released for. Aoife McDermott's had 4, I've had 1.5. How do you compete? So
is there a danger then that, I mean, the likes of yourself is looking at what's going on over there, and as you say, the professional contracts are back, and that's only going to raise all boats, I assume, that it'd be pretty tempting to get out of the game here, I'm sure, and go over there and earn some money out of it.
Well, yeah. I mean, if I was 10 years younger and a club over there felt I was good enough and I didn't have the family commitments I have, I would be gone, you know, because of my competitive nature. I want to be the best and to be put in an environment where, again, I'm pitching myself against the best in the world. That's where I want to be. And you can't deny people that if they're, you know, if you want to push that, you want to foster that. So again, I don't think there's no one person to blame, but as we can see, I think it was after 2010 when England won the World Cup, they reinvested that money and they put investment into the game. So they've been building for a large number of years. So I think it's the right structure. They made decisions at the right time and it paid off. It might have gone opposite for them, but I'm sort of thinking, how quickly do we fix this now when we've a World Cup qualification to look forward to, you know, Six Nations next year? And I think it'd be a very sad state of affairs to have a World Cup in 2021 without an Irish team, because regardless of how small this nation is, we make a big impact in the world, and we've seen that with world sporting events, and that's what we do, and that's what we do well, and we're competitive and we compete and we bring everything that's positive about sport, and I for one would be heartbroken if we weren't there.
Is there any sense that being out here more, because I think a lot of what you're talking about is encouraging and nurturing the grassroots and building it from there, is there any sense that on the other side of that too, the likes of yourselves been out on this pitch a bit more often, that might actually help grow the
100%. If you don't expose your athletes to the world, how will the world know them? And what better stage when in a historic venue, whether we're obviously talking about rugby, but there's been historic nights in soccer here as well. So again, we spoke about big sponsors who are, you know, influencers and powerful people and organisations sending a message to the world. I'm asking those people to do the same with women in sport and get behind us and take a chance and see where it can go, because I think we can go very far, and I think we've seen it in the States, we've seen it in other elite women's sports, that the AFL final, over 54 and a half thousand watched in the Oval. I want that in this day. Like, the lads knew their way around the Aviva. I've only been here as a spectator, and what I would give to play in front of a full stadium. Like, I'll take to my dying day the memories of running out onto Croke Park through that tunnel, and they're just some of my happiest memories, to play in the third largest stadium in Europe and to have that opportunity. And not all athletes will have that, and I want to change that, and I want to do all I can to action that change, not sit here with you as much as I'm enjoying it, but to talk about that.
Good. Well, I think the movement in general could do with more people like you and hearing more of that. In other words,
thank you very much
so far.
That was our conversation with Lindsay Peat at the Aviva Stadium during the week at the launch of the Union Cup, which took place in Dublin in the north side at DCU in June. On the day, we also spoke to James McGill, who's the HR director for Vodafone, who are one of the proud partners of the Union Cup, about their involvement in the tournament, Europe's largest LGBT inclusive rugby tournament. James, just tell us why Vodafone have gotten involved in the Union Cup Dublin this year.
Yeah, listen, we're delighted to be involved in the Union Cup. I think it sits really, really comfortably for us. At Vodafone Ireland, we really believe in diversity and inclusion. Yeah, so that everybody should be able to live their lives and come to work without judgment and without suffering bias. And for us as an employer, we think that's really important, because people bring their whole self to work and deliver their absolute best. So getting involved in something like the Union Cup, which is about diversity, which is about how we can support the LGBT community, absolutely delighted, and it fits really well with us.
And the women's tournament for the first time ever is, I know, again, very consistent with Vodafone's message.
Yeah, I know it is. I'm delighted to see that they're going to have a women's tournament for the first time. As you say, we have a long and proud history in terms of gender diversity. And that, again, it sits on the same ethos, yeah, that people should be able to live their lives and bring their best to work without judgment, yeah, without suffering unfair bias. And our emerging support for the LGBT community, which is probably over the past 3, 4, 5 years, has been grown out of that basis, grown out of that same ethos of equality and fairness for everybody.
Yeah, that was James McGill of Vodafone at that Union Cup launch during the week. You can check out all of his interviews with Lindsay Peat and Nigel Owens as well, all up on offtheball.com, and plenty more on that over the next while. And also including, I believe this evening, Cliona Foley of our Off the Bench podcast is going to be in conversation with Shirley Corcoran, who's the president of Railway Union Rugby Club, for the latest episode. And there will be some interesting stuff out of that. So that's coming your way on Off the Bench. Keep an eye on the Off the Ball social channels over the course of the day. We'll bring you more news on that. A busy weekend on Off the Ball upcoming. We're going to have live coverage of Crystal Palace against Manchester City on Sunday. And Dave McIntyre is going to be in the commentary box there alongside Gary Breen. We have, I believe, Nathan Murphy and Kevin Cabana duty for the big one this weekend at 4:30 start on Sunday. Liverpool up against Chelsea. Just both of those games obviously deciding which way, what turns the Premier League title race may take over the next couple of months in the run-in. So that's this weekend on Off the Ball on News Talk. Off the Ball live tonight, of course, from 7 o'clock with all your usual favourites of a Friday evening, Friday night racing, the crappy quiz, and plenty more as well, besides our new Game of Thrones show with Andy Lee. Bonus episode ahead of the return of the 8th and final season. We'll go live today. You can watch episode 1 and 2. They are all currently up on YouTube, so check those out. Listen back wherever you get your Spotify as well. Liam Cunningham, Bran Stark, and much more on this week's show. But that's pretty much it from us for this morning. OTB AM back on Monday from 7:45. Good morning.